Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, December 13, 2021. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by app, phone, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to join to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, we're going to pick up on our scripture reading from where we left off last week. We're in the Gospel of Luke. Let me see if I can find that. I think I got it. Nope, that's not it. Yes. Okay, we're in the Gospel of Luke. Looks like we're picking up on, I believe it's 14. Let me double check. Yep, 14. We're in the chapter 14, the Gospel of Luke, read by Alexander Scorby.
Chapter 14. And it came to pass, as he went into the house of one of the chief Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath day, that they watched him. And behold, there was a certain man before him which had the dropsy. And Jesus answering spake unto the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day? And they held their peace. And he took him, and healed him, and let him go, and answered them, saying, Which of you shall have an ass or an ox fallen into a pit, and will not straightway pull him out on the Sabbath day? And they could not answer him again to these things. And he put forth a parable to those which were bidden, when he marked how they chose out the chief rooms, saying unto them, When thou art bidden of any man to a wedding, sit not down in the highest room, lest a more honorable man than thou be bidden of him, and he that bade thee and him come and say to thee, Give this man place, and thou begin with shame to take the lowest room. But when thou art bidden, go and sit down in the lowest room, that when he that bade thee cometh, he may say unto thee, Friend, go up higher. Then shalt thou have worship in the presence of them that sit at meat with thee. For whosoever exalteth himself shall be abased, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted. Then said he also to him that bade him, When thou makest a dinner or a supper, call not thy friends nor thy brethren, neither thy kinsmen, nor thy rich neighbors, lest they also bid thee again, and a recompense be made thee. But when thou makest a feast, call the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind. And thou shalt be blessed, for they cannot recompense thee. For thou shalt be recompensed at the resurrection of the just. And when one of them that sat at meat with him heard these things, he said unto him, Blessed is he that shall eat bread in the kingdom of God. Then said he unto him, A certain man made a great supper, and bade many, and sent his servant at supper time to say to them that were bidden, Come, for all things are now ready. And they all, with one consent, began to make excuse. The first said unto him, I have bought a piece of ground, and I must needs go and see it. I pray thee have me excused. And another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I go to prove them. I pray thee have me excused. And another said, I have married a wife, and therefore I cannot come. So that servant came and showed his lord these things. Then the master of the house, being angry, said to his servant, Go out quickly into the streets and lanes of the city, and bring in hither the poor, and the maimed, and the halt, and the blind. And the servant said, Lord, it is done as thou hast commanded, and yet there is room. And the Lord said unto the servant, Go out into the highways and hedges, and compel them to come in, that my house may be filled. For I say unto you, that none of those men which were bidden shall taste of my supper. And there went great multitudes with him, and he turned and said unto them, If any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whosoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, sitteth not down first and counteth the cost, whether he have sufficient to finish it. Lest haply after he hath laid the foundation, and is not able to finish it, all that behold it begin to mock him, saying, This man began to build, and was not able to finish. Or what king, going to make war against another king, sitteth not down first, and consulteth whether he be able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is yet a great way off, he sendeth an embassage, and desireth conditions of peace. So likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if the salt have lost his savor, wherewith shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land, nor yet for the dunghill, but men cast it out. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear.
Okay, tonight the subject matter is going to be, it is on the true debate of our time. Now, this is a video's PowerPoint. Well, it's not a PowerPoint video, but it is a video. And I believe this was put together by Edward Griffin. And it's five parts. Each part's maybe about 9 minutes, 5 minutes. You know, collectively, it comes up to about 25 minutes long. So we're going to go through that today. A couple of things. Well, I guess we'll get into other things after we play this. We'll be opening up for open forum after we go through this process. Brent, I don't know if Brent is here yet, but Brent will be talking to us about something tonight, and then after that we'll move into an open forum. So there won't be a direct open forum right after this these videos, but we can open for discussions on the videos we're about to watch tonight. They're very good. I think you'll enjoy them. And let me see if I can get them going here. Hang on.
Collectivists and individualists both agree that human rights are important, but they differ over how important compared to other values, and especially over the origin of those rights. Rights are not tangible entities that can be viewed or measured. They are abstract concepts held in the human mind. They are whatever men agree they are at a given time and place. Because of the great diversity in the concept of human rights, they cannot be defined to everyone's satisfaction. But if we wish to live in a culture with the optimum amount of personal freedom, then we must be serious about a preferred definition of human rights. Because if we have no concept of what our rights should be, then it is likely that we will live under a definition not to our liking. The first thing to understand as we work towards a useful definition of rights is that their source determines their nature. This will be covered in greater detail further along, but the concept needs to be stated here. If we can agree on a source of rights, then we will have little difficulty agreeing on their nature. For example, if a security guard is hired by a gated community to protect the property of its residents, the nature of the guard's activity must be limited to the activities that the residents themselves are entitled to perform. That means the guard may patrol the community and, if necessary, physically deter burglaries and crimes of aggressive violence. But the guard is not authorized to compel residents to send their children to bed by 10 p.m. or to donate to the Red Cross. Why not? Because the residents are the source of the authority. The nature of the authority cannot include any act that is denied to the source, and the residents have no right to compel their neighbors in these matters. In societies that have been sheltered for many generations from war and revolution, it is easy to forget that rights are derived from military power. That is their ultimate source. Initially, rights must be earned on the battlefield. They may be handed to the next generation as a gift, but they are always purchased on the battlefield. The Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution is a classic example. The men who drafted that document were able to do so only because they represented the colonists who defeated the armies of Great Britain. Had they lost the War of Independence, they would have had no opportunity to write a Bill of Rights or anything else except letters of farewell before their execution. Unfortunately, Mao Zedong was right when he said that political power grows from the barrel of a gun. He could just as well have said rights. A man may declare that he has a right to do such and such derived from law, or from a constitution, or even from God, but in the presence of a criminal or a tyrant with a gun to his head, he has no power to exercise his proclaimed right. Rights are always based on power. If we lose our ability or our willingness to physically defend our rights, we will lose them. Now we come to the chasm between collectivists and individualists. If rights are earned on the battlefield, we may assume that they belong to the winners, but who are they? Do governments win wars, or do the people? If governments win wars, and the people merely serve them, as in medieval times, then governments hold the rights, and are entitled to grant or deny them to the people. On the other hand, if people win wars, and governments merely serve them in this matter, then the people hold rights, and are entitled to grant or deny them to governments. If our task is to define rights as we think they should be in a free society, then we must choose between these two concepts. Collectivists choose the concept that rights come from governments, and the people are the servants. Individualists are nervous about this assumption, because if the state has the power to grant rights, it also has the power to take them away, and that concept is incompatible with personal liberty. The view of individualism was expressed clearly in the United States Declaration of Independence, which said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men." The assumption is that rights are the innate possession of the people. The purpose of government is not to grant rights, but to secure them and protect them. By contrast, all collectivist political systems embrace the opposite view, that rights are granted by the state. That includes the Nazis, fascists, and communists. It is also a tenet of the United Nations. Article 4 of the UN Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights says, "The states parties to the present covenant recognize that, in the enjoyment of those rights provided by the state may subject such rights only to such limitations as are determined by law." I repeat, if we accept that the state has the power to grant rights, then we must also agree that it has the power to take them away. Notice the wording of the UN Covenant. After proclaiming that rights are provided by the state, it then says that those rights may be subject to limitations as are determined by law. In other words, the collectivists at the United Nations presume to grant us our rights, and then, when they are ready to take them away, all they have to do is pass the law authorizing it. Compare that with the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution. It says that Congress shall pass no law restricting the rights of freedom of speech or religion, peaceful assembly, the right to bear arms, and so forth, not except as are determined by law, but no law. The United States Constitution embodies the ethic of individualism. The UN embodies the ethic of collectivism, and what a difference it makes. We can see that individualists believe that the state cannot have any legitimate powers unless they are given it by the citizens. Another way of putting it is that governments may only do those things that their citizens also have a right to do. If individuals don't have a right to perform a certain act, then they can't grant that power to their elected representatives. They can't delegate what they don't have. It makes no matter how many of them there may be. If none of them have a specified power to delegate, then a million of them don't have it either. Let us use an extreme example of three men afloat at sea, struggling over a piece of debris that will only support two of them. Both collectivists and individualists would say that the two men would be justified in overpowering the third. The collectivist points out the greater good for the greater number. However, if we simplify the example so that there are only two men and the debris will only support one of them, we can see that an individual would still be justified in overpowering the other, because the right to self-survival is paramount. We can see that in the original example, there is no need for any group right to justify overpowering the third individual. When each man acts, they do it for their own individual right of self-survival. Using physical force to protect our lives, liberty, and property is the legitimate function of government, because that power is derived from the people as individuals. It does not arise from the group. Here's a more typical example. If government officials decide one day that no one should work on a Sunday, and even assuming the community generally supports their decision, where would they get the authority to use the police power of the state to enforce such a decree? individual citizens don't have a right to compel their neighbours not to work, so they can't delegate that right to their governments. So where then would the state get the authority? The answer is that it would come from itself. It would be self-generated. When governments claim to derive their authority from any source other than the governed, it always leads to the destruction of liberty. Preventing men from working on a Sunday would not seem to be a great threat to freedom, but once the principle is established, it opens the door for more edicts, and more, until freedom is gone. If we accept that the state or any group has the right to do things that individuals alone do not have the right to do, then we have unwittingly endorsed the concept that rights are not intrinsic to the individual, and that they in fact do originate with the state. Once we accept that, we are on the road to tyranny. As we shall see in part 2, collectivists are not concerned over such picky issues. They believe that governments do in fact have powers that are greater than those of the citizens. And the source of those powers, they say, is not the individuals in society, but society itself. The next concept that divides collectivism from individualism is group supremacy. Collectivism is based on the belief that the group is more important than the individual. According to this view, the group is an entity of its own, and it has rights of its own. Furthermore, those rights are more important than individual rights. Therefore, it is acceptable to sacrifice individuals if necessary for the greater good of the greater number. Who can object to the loss of liberty if it is justified as necessary for the greater good of society? The ultimate group is, of course, the state. Therefore, the state is more important than individual citizens. And it is acceptable to sacrifice individuals, if necessary, for the benefit of the state. This concept is at the heart of all modern totalitarian systems, built on the model of collectivism. Individualists, on the other hand, argue that there is no such thing as a group. You can't touch a group, you can't see a group. All you can touch and see are individuals. The word group is an abstraction that does not exist as a tangible reality. It's like the abstraction called a forest. Forests do not exist. Only trees exist. Forest is the concept of many trees. Likewise, the word group merely describes the abstract concept of many individuals. Only individuals are real, and therefore there is no such thing as group rights. Only individuals have rights. Just because there are many individuals in one group and only a few in another does not give a higher priority to the individuals in the larger group, even if you call it the state. A majority of voters do not have more rights than the minority. Rights are not derived from the power of numbers. They do not come from the group. They are intrinsic with each human being. When someone argues that individuals must be sacrificed for the greater good of society, what they are really saying is that some individuals are to be sacrificed for the greater good of other individuals. The morality of collectivism is based on numbers. Anything may be done so long as the number of people benefiting is supposedly greater than the number of people being sacrificed. I say supposedly because, in the real world, those who decide who is to be sacrificed don't count fairly. Dictators always claim that they represent the greater good of the greater number, but in reality, they and their support organizations usually comprise less than 1% of the population. The theory is that someone has to speak for the masses and represent their best interests because they are too dumb to figure it out for themselves. So collectivist leaders, wise and virtuous as they are, make decisions for them. In this way, it is possible to explain any atrocity or injustice as a necessary measure for the greater good of society. Modern totalitarians always parade themselves as humanitarians. Because individuals do not accept group supremacy, collectivists often portray them as being selfish and insensitive to the needs of others. That theme is common in schools today. If a child is not willing to go along with the group, he is criticized as being socially disruptive and not a good team player or a good citizen. But individualism is not based on ego. It is based on principle. If you accept the premise that individuals may be sacrificed for the group, you have made a large mistake on two counts. First, individuals are the essence of the group, which means the group is being sacrificed anyway, piece by piece. Secondly, the underlying principle is deadly. Today, the individual being sacrificed may be unknown to you or even someone you dislike. Tomorrow, it could be you. It takes but a moment's reflection to realize that the greater good of the greater number is not achieved by sacrificing individuals, but by protecting individuals. Society is best served by individualism, not collectivism. We are dealing here with one of the reasons that people make a distinction between republics and democracies. In recent years, we have been taught to believe that a democracy is the ideal form of government. Supposedly, that is what was created by the American Constitution. But closer examination of the documents and the speech transcripts of the men who wrote the Constitution, you find that they spoke very poorly of democracy. They said in plain words that a democracy was one of the worst possible forms of government, and so they created what they called a republic. That is why the word democracy doesn't appear anywhere in the Constitution, and when Americans pledge allegiance to the flag, it is to the republic for which it stands, not the democracy. The reason this is important is that the difference between a democracy and a republic is the difference between collectivism and individualism. In a pure democracy, the majority rules. Consider a lynch mob. There is only one person with a dissenting vote, and he is at the end of a rope. That is pure democracy in action. A republic is a government based on the principle of limited majority rule, so that the minority, even a minority of one, will be protected from the whims and passions of the majority. Republics are often characterized by written constitutions that spell out the rules that make that possible. That was the function of the American Bill of Rights, which is nothing more than a list of things that the government may not do. It says that Congress, even though it represents the majority, shall pass no law denying the minority their rights to free exercise of religion, freedom of speech, peaceful assembly, the right to bear arms, and other unalienable rights. These limitations on majority rule are the essence of a republic, and they are also at the core of the ideology called individualism. There is another major difference between these two concepts. Collectivism on the one hand, supporting any government action so long as it can be said to be for the greater good of the greater number, and individualism on the other hand, defending the rights of the minority against the passions and greed of the majority. In the next part of this series, we look to the divide over coercion versus freedom. We will examine the collectivist morality that justifies the use of force to deprive individuals from private property, if it is for charitable reasons, and the individualist morality that believes that voluntary actions are at the core of the term charity.
Providing for themselves. These are group obligations of the state. The individualist expects to do it himself. The collectivist wants the government to do it for him, to provide employment and healthcare, a minimum wage, food, education, and a decent place to live. Collectivists are enamored by government. They worship it and are fixated by government as the ultimate group mechanism to solve all problems. Individualists do not share this faith, and they see government as the creator of more problems than it solves. They believe that freedom of choice will lead to the best solution of social and economic problems by comparing millions of ideas and efforts, each one subject to trial and error and competition. The results are far superior to what can be achieved by a group of politicians or a committee of so-called wise men. By contrast, collectivists do not trust freedom. They are afraid of freedom. They are convinced that freedom may be alright in small matters such as what colour socks you want to wear, but when it comes to important issues such as the money supply, banking practices, investments, insurance programs, healthcare, education and so on, freedom will not work. These things, they say, simply must be controlled by the government. Otherwise, there would be chaos. There are two reasons for the popularity of that concept. The first is that most of us have been educated in government schools, and that is what we were taught. The second is that government is the one group that can legally force everyone to participate. It has the power of taxation, backed by jails and force of arms, to compel everyone to fall in line. And that is a very appealing concept to the intellectual who pitches himself as a social engineer. They believe it is their obligation to mankind, as the enlightened ones, to make decisions on the behalf of society, for most are too dumb to know what their own best interests are. Individualists also believe that they are right, and that the masses seldom do what they should. But they do not accept that you can force people to comply with your will. To do this would be to establish a principle that would open the door for others, representing larger groups, to compel them to act as they decree. And that would be the end of freedom. One of the quickest ways to spot a collectivist is to see how he reacts to public problems. No matter what bothers him on his daily routine, whether it's littering the highway, smoking in public, dressing indecently, bigotry, or even sending out junk mail, his immediate response is, there ought to be a law. Of course, the professionals in government who make a living from coercion are more than happy to cooperate. The consequence is that government just keeps growing and growing. It is a one-way street. Every year there are more and more laws and less and less freedom. Each law by itself seems relatively benign, justified by some convenience or for the greater good of the greater number. But the process continues indefinitely until government is total and freedom is dead. Bit by bit, the people themselves become a solicitor of their own enslavement. A good example of this collectivist mindset is the use of government to perform actions of charity. Most people believe that we have a responsibility to help others in need. But what about those who disagree? Those who couldn't care less about the needs of others? Should they be allowed to be selfish while the rest of us are so generous? The collectivist sees people like this as justification for the use of coercion, because the cause is so worthy. Of course, not all of it gets to the poor. It takes a giant bureaucracy to administer a public charity, and the individuals in government have become accustomed to a huge portion of that wealth, while the peasants are grateful for whatever they can get. They don't care how much is consumed in the process, because, after all, it was stolen from someone else anyway. We all know the biblical story of the Good Samaritan, who stopped to help a stranger who had been robbed and beaten. But what would we think if the Samaritan had pointed his sword at the next traveller and threatened to kill him if he didn't also help? At that point, the Samaritan would have been no different to the original robber, whose motive for attacking the victim could well have been to feed his family or to afford a better doctor for his wife. Regardless, a crime done for virtuous motives is a crime nonetheless. When coercion enters, charity leads. Individualists believe that a person should be free not to be charitable. If they prefer to give to a different charity, if they prefer to give a smaller amount, or if they prefer not to give at all, there is no right to force them to our will. We may try and persuade him, we may appeal to his conscience, and especially, we may show the way by our own good example. But individualists reject any attempt to gang up on him, either by physically restraining him while removing money from his pockets, or by using the ballot box to pass laws that will take his money through taxation. In either case, the principle is the same. It's called stealing. Collectivists would have you believe that individualism is merely another word for selfishness, because individualists oppose welfare and other forms of coercive redistribution of wealth. But just the opposite is true. Individualists advocate true charity, which is the voluntary giving of their own money, while collectivists advocate the coercive giving of other people's money, which is, of course, why it's so popular. One of the most popular slogans of Marxism is, each according to his ability, to each according to his need. That is the cornerstone of theoretical socialism, and it is very appealing, but it is an incomplete concept. The unanswered question is how? How is this to be accomplished? Shall it be in freedom or through coercion? For the individualist, a worthy objective does not justify committing theft or surrendering freedom, while for the collectivist, the ends justify the means. In the next part of this series, we examine equality and inequality under law. We will study how collectivists use government for welfare and to enforce racial or gender quotas in order to bring about a more equal society. We'll also study the opposite view of individualism, that regardless of personal inequalities, of means or circumstances among individuals. The fifth concept that divides collectivism from individualism has to do with the way that people are treated under the law. Individualists believe that no two people are exactly alike, and that each one is superior or inferior to others in a huge variety of ways, but that under the law, they should all be treated equally. Collectivists believe that the law should treat people unequally in order to bring about desirable changes in society. They view the world as tragically imperfect. They see poverty and suffering and injustice, and they conclude that something must be done to alter the forces that have produced these effects. They think of themselves as social engineers who have the wisdom to restructure society to a more humane and logical order. To do this, they must interfere in the affairs of men at all levels and redirect their activities according to a master plan. That means they must redistribute wealth and use the police power of the state to enforce prescribed behavior. The consequence of this mindset can be seen everywhere in society today. Almost every country in the world has a tax system designed to treat people unequally depending on their income, their marital status, the number of children they have, their age, and even the type of investments they may have. The purpose of this arrangement is to redistribute wealth, which means to favor some classes over others. In some cases, there are bizarre loopholes written into the tax laws just to favor one corporation or one politically influential group. Other laws provide tax exemption and subsidies to favored groups or corporations. Inequality is the sole purpose of these laws. In the realm of social relationships, there are laws to establish racial quotas, gender quotas, affirmative action initiatives, and to prohibit expressions of opinion that may be objectionable to some group or to the master planners. In all of these measures, there is an unequal application of the law based on what group or class you happen to be in, or on what opinion you hold. We are all told that this is necessary to accomplish a desirable change in society, and yet, after more than 100 years of social engineering, there is not one place on the globe where collectivists can point with pride and show where their master plan has actually worked as they predicted. Let us use an example of a basketball league where some of the teams were forced during the last season to play with one arm tied behind their backs, while others could play without constraint. Of course, neither individualists or collectivists would consider this arrangement fair. Now, suppose that someone proposed that for the next several seasons, those teams whose players had been untied were now to play all of their games with an arm tied behind their backs, while those who had been tied up now had both arms free. Is the arrangement now fair? Before we answer, let's improve the analogy. Let's observe that there has been a complete turnover of players. All those who played in the first set of games have retired. The current players, therefore, are newcomers, none of whom were involved with the original practice. Let's ask again, is the arrangement now fair? It is important to identify one crucial premise in this example. It identifies the players as individuals rather than members of a collective team. Let us use a more contemporary example of groups who, historically, have had the rules of the game biased against them, such as the Indigenous peoples of Australia and Canada, or the Native Americans of the United States. Their struggle has been against the racism and inequality that inhibits their opportunities. Both collectivists and individualists would agree that the rules of the game need to be changed so that they can play with both hands untied. But what would we say if collectivists went even further and changed the rules so that ancestors of native people were guaranteed employment, given welfare payments, or even made exempt from paying taxes just because they belong to the group, regardless of how well off the individual may be? In their quest for equal rights, is the collectivist strategy for swapping negative inequality for positive inequality likely to be successful? The individualist believes that this path will reach further resentment as it continues the fostering of a society that only sees each other as members of groups, eternally different and forever struggling for preferential treatment under the law at the expense of others. There have been many books written about the collectivist utopia, but they have never materialized in the real world. Wherever collectivism has been applied, the results have always been more poverty than before, more suffering than before, and certainly more injustice than before. Individualism is based on the premise that all citizens should be equal under law, regardless of their religion, their race, their gender, their lifestyle, or their political opinion. No class should be given preferential treatment, regardless of the merit or the popularity of its cause. To favour one class over another is not equality under law. In the final part of this series, we explore the proper role of government. We look at the difference between an individualist and a collectivist state and where each government will take its society. Time has come to do away with all the confusing definitions, the illusion of opposites, and the myth that the world is too complicated to properly understand. All of these issues are far more simple than we could have imagined. There is the approach of collectivism and the approach of individualism. Now that we have examined the true origin of human rights, the fallacy of group supremacy, the immorality of using coercion, and the need for equality under law, one question remains. What is the proper role of government? Collectivists believe that the proper role of government should be positive. the state should take the initiative in all aspects of the affairs of men, that it should be aggressive, lead, and provide. It should be the great organizer of society. Individualists believe that the proper function of government is negative and defensive. It is not to provide, but to protect. For if the state is granted the power to provide for some, it must also be able to take from others. And once that power is granted, there are those who will seek it for their advantage. It always leads to legalized plunder and the loss of freedom. If the government is powerful enough to give us everything we want, it is also powerful enough to take from us everything we have. Therefore, the proper function of government is to protect the lives, liberty, and property of its citizens, and nothing more. We hear a lot today about right-wingers versus left-wingers, but what do these terms really mean? For example, we are told that communists and socialists are at the extreme left, and that Nazis and fascists are on the extreme right. Here we have this image of two powerful ideological adversaries pitted against each other, and the impression is that somehow they are opposites. But what is the difference? They are not opposites at all. They are the same. The insignias may be different, but when you analyze communism and Nazism, they both embody the principles of socialism. Communists are clear that they embody socialism, and the Nazi movement in Germany was actually called the National Socialist Party. Communists believe in international socialism, whereas Nazis advocate national socialism. Communists promote class hatred and class conflict to motivate loyalty and the blind obedience of their followers, whereas the Nazis use race conflict and race hatred to accomplish the same objective. Other than that, there is no difference between communism and Nazism. They are both the epitome of collectivism, and yet we are told that they are supposedly at opposite ends of the spectrum. There is only one thing that makes sense in constructing a political spectrum, and that is to put zero government at one end of the line and 100% at the other. Now we have something that we can comprehend. Those who believe in zero government are the anarchists, while those who believe in total government are the totalitarians. With that definition, we find that communism and Nazism are together at the same end. They are both totalitarian. Why? Because they are both based on the model of collectivism. Communism, Nazism, fascism, and socialism all gravitate towards bigger and bigger government because that is the logical extension of their common ideology. Under collectivism, all problems are the responsibility of the state and must be solved by the state. The more problems there are, the more powerful the state must become. If you accept the principle that government must solve society's problems, you get on the slippery slope, and there is no place to stop until you reach all the way to the end of the scale, which is total government. Regardless of what name you give it, regardless of how you relabel it to make it seem new or different, collectivism is totalitarianism. In fact, the straight line concept of a political spectrum is somewhat misleading. It is really a circle. You can take the straight line with 100% government at one end and zero at the other, bend it round and touch the ends at the top. Now, it is a circle because under anarchy, when there is no government, you have absolute rule by those with the biggest fists and the most powerful weapons. So you jump from zero government to totalitarianism in a flash. They meet at the top. When dealing with a circle, the only logical place for us to be is somewhere in the middle of the extremes. We need social and political organization, of course, but it must be built on individualism, an ideology with an affinity to that part of the spectrum with the least amount of government possible, instead of collectivism with an affinity at the other end of the spectrum with the most amount of government possible. That government is best which governs least, governs least, governs least, governs least, governs least.
Okay. All right. Those videos were put together as a series of five videos. It was put together by G. Edward Griffin. And, you know, we have many of G. Edward Griffin's videos. They're really a lot of documentaries. He's been working on documentaries. He's a pioneer, really, of really digging deep and exposing what was really going on. And I believe I heard of him. I've seen some video that he did where he was doing something, gathering people in his home, and a video was taken of that. And that goes back to, I think it was 1959 or 1960. So he's been doing this for quite some time. And he's put some amazing documentaries out there, just amazing. He's got at least 20, maybe 25 documentaries out there. Most of his documentaries are included in our civics course. Really, because when you string them all together, he lays out exactly how they pulled off, how the New World Order has pulled off taking control of our government. Again, this goes all the way back to the Revolution, and it actually started even pre-government here in New York, in the United States. It goes back to 1750, when the Bar Association was established in the colonies in order to destroy our common law and to bring the people back under the rule of the king. And so revolution, of course, in 1776, and eventually the Constitution. But the revolution that really never ended. It continues. It continued covertly. Now, of course, you know, it has become overt again, and we're starting to see the end results of it. So anyway, a lot of his videos are up here. I believe it's under education is where we have a lot of them. We're going to be restructuring a lot of our, you know, pages and layouts and what we're doing. I'm working right now, and I'm hoping to have these two courses up by the 18th. On the 18th, we're going to be having a seminar on government by consent. It's going to be maybe up to 3 hours long. It's a little over two. It's about 2 hours maybe, but then there's going to be an open forum, and I'm sure that open forum will run about an hour, so it'll be 3 hours, pretty much as our Monday night programs are. And could run longer than that, whatever it takes to really talk and try to answer as many questions as possible or get as much information from others as possible, corrections or whatever is necessary. So again, that's going to be on Saturday. Hopefully everyone will come on the 18th, which is next Saturday coming up at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to start shop at 1 p.m. I suggested everybody come early, especially those who have just learning how to maybe download the apps. I strongly suggest that you download the necessary apps that can be used with your browser or with your smartphone, because then you can get the visual. Definitely the seminar is a visual and audio seminar, so there's going to be a lot of visual assistance to what we're going to be learning, you know, verbally. So your best results would be on a browser from a computer because it's large enough to see everything. Second would be a smartphone. Of course, a tablet is good, I guess. Third, of course, is a regular phone, any kind of phone you can get in and listen. And you can get a lot of out of what we're doing, of course, without the visuals. But, again, the visuals really help quite a bit. So again, that's Saturday, this coming Saturday, the 18th, at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I strongly suggest people come early, come in, you know, 12:30 to 12:45. And again, those who are just learning how to use the apps and put things together, they need time. They should be working on that. Now, we have about 1,300 people who have signed up to become administrators. Jury administrators, and for those who may be new and don't know exactly what jury administrators are, we're working to get four jury administrators and one paralegal, which will also be a jury administrator, but we need a paralegal secretary to really work the paperwork and do a lot of the functions necessary that a paralegal would really be best to do. But any of us could learn the system, and but nevertheless, we need five people for every county. Now, these are professional paid positions. It's a career position. I would believe a very rewarding position because you get to work with the juries, the grand juries, the trial juries. You get to do the orientation to make sure that they're fully informed jurors. Right now, the process that is going forward, of course, is part of the statutory process. And I found out recently, at least it appears everywhere to be the same thing, that this is for the commissioners of jurors who really establishes the relationship with the juries once they're called for. And they're all bar attorneys. And that's interesting, of course. You know, the bar has really destroyed our entire nation. It's destroyed our judicial system, our political system, and just about everything out there. Even our medical system, and just about every large corporation you could think of, they've gotten their hands onto and have destroyed things and have really brought everything underneath themselves. So they've really made a mess of our nation, and we need to fix it. So we the people need to take it back. We can no longer trust the government themselves, any part of the government, to take control of the most important functions of liberty, and that is to control our political and our judicial processes. We the people must do that. Common law is a people's thing. It's the people is the grand jury. The people are the trial juries. They decide. They're the sovereigns who decide the law. And if they don't like a law that the government might throw at them, they just nullify it. And again, a government has no right to write any law that governs our behavior at all. Any laws that are written in statutes and codes are for people who are individuals that work for agencies or commercial activities. On the federal level, it would be interstate commercial activities. On the state level, of course, it would be within the state commercial activities. We gave them authority on the federal level in Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution, 8 of the Constitution, I'm sorry. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution is where we gave them the powers to write laws. Right, and this is man-made law, so therefore it's called statutes or codes and even regulations that control the agencies. Once a criminal, once something turns criminal, it then becomes a court of law and no longer a court of equity, because that's what a court of equity is, one that is established and run by the codes. But once it becomes a criminal situation, it now must move into a court of law. So if a person is being judged under some codes or violation or statute violations that they were supposed to be acting under. So they are held to those things, those people who work for government agencies, those people who are involved in certain commercial activities interstate. They are governed by those things, regulations, codes, and statutes. And when they violate those, then there's a consequence to that. And if it becomes a criminal thing, again, in equity courts, decisions are made by a judge, one individual, a judge, but there's an appellate process to that, so you can appeal it. If you don't like the decision, but once it becomes criminal, it must become a court of law, and that's where the people decide. They must get an indictment. And the people may not like the law that they're applying on the individual or whatever, and they may nullify it. But generally speaking, it would go into a trial by jury. And the jury may look at that and may nullify the law and may decide on something different. But of course, the jury's focus is always on restitution, not necessarily putting people in jail. Of course, there are certain things that people do that they deserve to go to jail. But that's up to the jury to decide. And so the government has no part in a court of law. There's a magistrate that he's sort of like a traffic cop, moves things along, but is not to make any decisions on the case and cannot throw the case out. If the case has no merit, it should go through anyway, and it'll be found that it has no merit. But judges cannot throw it out. And that could be any kind of a case we're talking about, not necessarily a case that is criminal. Now, as I mentioned, the commission of jurors, they control the jury process. They can no longer be trusted. We must take this away from them. And that's why we're working for the people in every county to step up and take control of these processes. And we're calling them the jury administrators. And again, as I mentioned, they'd be responsible for orientating the jury and advising the jury and so on. Now, we have a couple of courses going on that. And as I mentioned, we have about 1,300 administrators, people who have signed up for that. Anybody who wants to sign up for that, you can go to your My Account. Okay, you can click on My Account, and then under your account, if you go through it, you'll see a box where you can check to become an administrator. And then you would be registered as administrator within the state and the county that you joined under. When you joined, you should have checked the box that tells us what state you're from and what county you're from. And so if you become administrator for that county, then you then become registered for that. And then it's up to you to get the proper education. National Liberty Alliance is certifying the individuals who are taking those roles. And again, it's a career opportunity. It's a paid position with benefits. And but you must be qualified to do so. Now, our courses are quite simple. You know, we didn't want to make anything complex. We really want people to just go through the process, not to get frustrated or anything, but to go through the process and get familiar with common law, to get familiar with our Constitution and the history about our founding fathers and who we are as a people and where we come from. And that, of course, all falls under natural law. We also wanted people to get familiar with how we became, how we got to where we are today. I mean, we have a constitutional crisis, and it has been building for a very long time. I saw it being built up when I was a child. I didn't recognize it necessarily as I look back and remember the things that were going on. I can see now what was going on. Back then, of course, from the eyes of a child, you don't necessarily see, because you have to have certain experience in order to be able to see certain things. Lately, of course, I know for the last 20 years or so, I mean, this is when I woke up about 20 years ago, roughly, 1999, and I started to understand that there was a serious problem. Didn't understand what it was and how it came and, you know, and how can we get rid of it. And, you know, I didn't know those things. But over time, of course, trying to work out the problem, being frustrated with the situation, looking for solutions, some of us found things that we do need to do. And we did discover here at National Liberty Alliance how to have government by consent. There is a process. There's something that our founding fathers have set up for us. It's called the Committees of Safety. It's how they took control. But going back to the administrators of the jury, again, we have a lot of people, 1,300. We need to fill 15,000 positions. That's five people in every county, about 3,000 counties. So it's about 15,000 positions that need to be filled. And we have 1,300 of those positions already filled. But some of those people are not moving through the courses. And I can guarantee you those people will not get the position. If someone else comes in and goes through the courses, it doesn't matter who came first then, whoever gets through the courses first, those are the people that are going to take these positions. Now, of course, there'll be a lot of positions still open once we move forward into this process, and they'll need to be filled, and they'll need to be filled quickly. As long as people are going through the process, then they can take on the position. But then we would require them to complete that process within a certain amount of time and get their certifications. But without a certification, you cannot have the position. Now, as I was saying, we have quite a few different courses up here, and the administrator must take them all. We have a constitutional course. It's a very, very simple course, nothing complex. It's really more of an introduction to the Constitution. We have a civics course, which is about 120 hours long, lots of videos, lots of audios, really, really informative, and you'll understand exactly how America got to the place it is today. As a matter of fact, most of the explanation of these things is really done by Griffin, G. Edward Griffin, who did the videos we were just listening to. We also have a militia course. We have a government by consent course. We have a course that was up there, and you know we're redoing it, and hopefully it'll be up soon. I'm waiting for a couple of people to finish off on a few things to put it together, and I'd like to say that we'll get it up by the 18th, which is when our seminar is. But if it's not up by the 18th, it'll be up after. But it's called the foundational course, or the foundational study. We'll call it a course because we want people to get certification of this for those people who are going to run, or try not run for, but take those positions as administrators, jury administrators. So those courses, you know, when you take those courses, it'll be registered on your username here with National Liberty Alliance. And at some point, when we look at the people who want to become administrators, jury administrators, we will see what courses they have taken. So they need to take every single course. And there's one other course that's being put, and it is going to be on a much higher level of really education. It's going to require some real good brain work on it. Anybody could pass it if you spend the time on it, and you got plenty of time to spend on it. You just got to work through it, you know. And if you think, you know, each chapter, I think it's going to be about 8 chapters long. Each chapter, you know, you come at the end of a chapter, you have a test. It's just like you went to school, you had a textbook, and at the end of the chapter, you took a test. And at the end of the year, you took a test on everything. Well, we have a test at the end of each chapter. And like I said, we kind of made it very easy for most of the courses that we put up. Again, we want people to become familiar with things. And, you know, so the more and more you hear and more you look at in a certain subject matter, the more and more you retain and more you understand, and the big picture comes into play and you get a better understanding. The more time you spend with something, then the easier it becomes as time goes on. But this final course, or the course is administrative course, that course, like I said, it's going to be a lot more difficult than the courses that have come before, because the people have to be qualified for the job that they're about to take. So they have to take all the courses and then get that final course, and then they get their certificate of completion. Now, one of the courses, which is a government by consent course, is required that you be a premier member, and that would also apply to the administrator course too. You have to be a premier member, and a premier member is someone who gives $5 a month or more. So if you give up a coffee and a bagel once a month, you're in. That's all it is. There's no big deal. Most everyone can afford it. There's very, very few people who can't afford $5. And we have had people who are really, you know, very limited income, Social Security, and they can't really afford that $5, and I can appreciate that. And so we do give them free access. So if anybody's in that kind of a situation, we'll do that. But only if you're really, really at that kind of a situation. Everyone else can really afford $5 a month. And it's only $60 a year. And that's what keeps the lights on, so to speak, here at National Liberty Alliance. So, again, we're looking for people to take on these positions. We have a lot of people that claim to have taken them on, but a lot of them are sleeping. And it doesn't matter how long ago they clicked the button. Whoever comes in and clicks that button and gets that course done, or further along in the courses, when it's time to be hired, those are the people that are going to take those jobs. Now, you don't have to work in the county that you live in, though. You could, you know, live in the county next door or whatever. It's a job. I know for me, close to me and where I'm at, but, you know, you could be living in a county where, you know, maybe you come across the bridge or just across the county line to the other county, and right there is the courthouse. And maybe in your own county, maybe it's all the way on the other side of the county. So for whatever reason, convenience or whatever, if you wanted to work in another county, you could do that. But you do want to make change of your county location then on your, you know, when you joined, you can go up to your account and make a change on that county location. So that we'll be able to know who has taken what positions and what positions will be open or available. So, again, these courses are a requirement. Now, I'm also working, and I'm almost complete with this also. Both of these courses that I mentioned, I know the one I'm talking about right now, which is the administrator course, that is completed already. I'm just working through questions for it, and I'll be posting it, and I should get it posted before the 18th, so sometime during the week it'll be up there. The other course, again, I hope to get done and up there also this week. We'll see what happens. But at the end of that course, there will be an administrator's handbook that'll be download. People who complete the course can download the administrator's handbook. Many people have asked for that administrator's handbook, and I haven't been able to complete it, but it's just about completed now. By the time the course is up there, I should have the handbook done also. So that book can be downloaded once you complete the course. Eventually, we will post that handbook for anyone to get under our pages, our handbook pages. If you come under People's Duty and come down to handbooks, you'll find all of National Liberty Alliance's handbooks. And anybody that's new here or really starting out, I would strongly suggest to open up the Jurist Handbook, which is right about here. Just open up that Jurist Handbook and read through that. It's 38 pages, extremely powerful, and it lays out the power and the authority of we, the people. That is the first and most important thing people need to understand, that we are sovereign people. We are the kings of our own domain, our own whatever it is we create in life, we're kings of that part of our life. And this handbook will help you clearly see that point. The sovereign makes the law. That's important. That's why juries have the power of jury nullification. That's why juries have the power to accept or deny a request for an indictment under the grand jury. So they have to come. Government has to come to the people to ask for an indictment. Then government has to come to the people for the people to decide innocent or guilty or whatever it is that they decide and whatever the penalty would be. And again, penalty should always be with an eye on restitution. Today, you go to court in a criminal situation, the person who is the injured party gets zero, zip, nada, nothing. They don't get anything, okay? They're abused, they're being brought into the court to go through this whole process, and then they leave and they get nothing. Okay, go to the civil court, find a lawyer, spend a lot of money to get it. Well, that's not the way justice is. In common law, the whole focus is on for every injury, there must be a remedy. So the remedy must be to restore that injured party. And that's the focus. Again, certain crimes, violent crimes, people who are tyrants, okay, these people belong in jail. But again, that's up to the jury to make those decisions on what that punishment might be. So we can totally ignore the law, and we should, generally speaking, ignore the law. When it needs to be applied to an individual working for an agency or a commercial activity or something, we're going to adjust the law the way we think would be most just. Because we're not interested in upholding the law. We're interested in upholding justice. That's what we're interested in. So anyway, we must take back our judicial system. That is government by consent, which gives us the power to put the fear into the government. Because if they're going to continue to break their word and break their oaths and commit all these criminal activities, then we're going to indict them. And then we're going to bring them into a court and we're going to convict them. And the people will deal and decide what to do with them. So that's government by consent. That's power. That's authority. Political process, same thing. I don't want to get too much into that today, but we also need to take back the political process. Now, we do have a lot of information for those people who might be new on this. You know, again, you come to these books. The books really get you through everything. Okay, we have the Committee Man Handbook. We have the Committee of Safety Organizing Handbook, the Committee of Safety Resolutions, the Committee of Safety Vow, the Committee of Safety Charter. We have the Common Law Handbook. We have the Jurist Handbook, the Militia Codes and Rules and Resolution Handbook. And we have the Sheriff's Handbook. So anybody wants to figure out what it is that they need to read first and look at those handbooks, because those are the books that are going to empower you. We're going to be putting under the Education tab, which we already did, Start Here, which I may move that tab up to the blue line, probably will, okay? And that's going to be really a page that's going to help people to see how to look at our website, how to get educated, how to go through the process. So I'm in the process of putting that together right now. And again, I got, today's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I got four more days before we come to Saturday, which is the 18th. I'm going to see what I could do about getting that together by then. But if not, at least not long after that, I should be able to get that up. but I'm going to endeavor to try to do that beforehand and put that together. We also have a higher education, you know, more like the college level, if you want to call it, which is really self-education, okay? And we have all the information. We're going to lay that out in the Start Here page. So that'll be the pivotal page where people will come. This is where you start, and we'll lay out how to look at our website, how to get educated, how to form committees of safety, how to become an administrator, and everything you need to know. I'm talking about a jury administrator. You know, there are also lots of positions that are available at the upper end of National Liberty Alliance, the leadership. So anybody who wants to volunteer for that, those are voluntary positions. But they will at some point in time, many of those positions will become paid positions because we'll be looking for people to be doing work, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. So that'll eventually happen. Right now it's all volunteer, and whatever time you can give us would be good. You'll also be starting to get educated in the processes that we need for people to do, and people will find a place that they want to work in, and then when those positions become a paid position, then they will get paid and have a potential career. Okay, let me see what else. Jury administrators, okay. Jury administrators must and should attend our Monday night calls. And if you don't attend them, you should be able to pick them up. You know, you can go up to our page here, which is our weekly call page. You click on that, and underneath that, you can find all of the past Monday night programs. We have audios on that. We now, though, are going to be posting them up on Rumble. We do have a Rumble page. You can go to Rumble, go click on that, and you go up to Rumble. Here's our page, National Liberty Alliance. And we have about 40 or 50 videos up there right now. Lots of information. It's all a lot of studies, you know. Power of the Committee of Safety, the duty of the county sheriff. But we're also going to be posting National Liberty Alliance's weekly call. Now, I got a couple more I want to put up there, and I'll put tonight's up there, of course. And I'm going to look in to see about streaming. You know, we have a radio program that we broadcast at the same time, live radio, as we have our Monday night program. We want to do the same thing with Rumble. We're not going to do it on YouTube. We do have a YouTube page, and we'll continue to post some stuff up there, but we're really making our home at Rumble at this point. Hopefully next week we'll be able to stream our call in opposed to just posting it up. So people who want to watch it come live on that, they can come live there. And if they want to ask questions and they want to still do it on Rumble, they can send their questions into questions, it's plural, questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Now, again, about the next Saturday seminar, 1 p.m. Eastern time, come early, especially those who have not figured out the apps yet. Test them out, figure out what you got to do. So it's on the 18th, 1 p.m. Eastern time, sharp, we're going to start. Definitely come a few minutes early at minimum. People should, every jury administrator should be at this particular seminar. If they can't make it, they need to let us know. Send us a note at mail, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Tell us you're an administrator, and if you can't make it, then we'll make sure you'll be able to get that, go see it on a play somewhere else, probably on Rumble or something. Let's see what else. Oh, everybody is probably aware or maybe even belongs to liberty groups in their own their own counties or towns or whatever. You should give a call to the people and that are in those liberty groups and invite them to this seminar. I should hope if they come to the seminar, they'll join us in the endeavor to save this republic through committees of safety. And again, we're going to learn a lot about the committees of safety, how they came to be, what our founding fathers did to create this nation. They created it through committees of safety. The pilgrims created committees of safety when they came here. So from the very beginning of the colonies, the beginning of coming to America, like the pilgrims, I mean, already, that was the process they used to govern themselves. And during the 1700s, particularly 1730, 40, 50, 60, and so on, a lot of problems were in the colonies. And so the people had already created the committees of safety and were using them in order to have self-government. So what the king didn't supply for them, the people themselves supplied for themselves and worked it out. That's what the Committee of Safety is. And then once, of course, this nation was created and the Constitution was established and became a fact in 1789, from that point forward, our Founding Fathers continued in the Committees of Safety. So we're going to learn a lot about that and how we can use the Committees of Safety to save our republic. And by the way, there is no other way. Let me repeat that. There is no other way to save this nation, to save this republic, but through the Committees of Safety. You can call them by a different name, but you have to do the work of the Committees of Safety. You have to take control of the political process. You have to take control of the judicial process. You have to bind these people down with the chains of the Constitution. We have to have a government that fears the people, because only until we have a government that fears the people will we have liberty and we will have freedom. Until then, as long as the people fear the government, and that seems to be where we're at today, you know, we have tyranny. We have a problem. And we have a constitutional crisis. So, there is no other way. I challenge anyone to show me any other way. You know, we're up to doing whatever we need to do to save this republic. But I'm confident that there's nothing else. Because, again, our Founding Fathers did not leave us helpless. They didn't leave us without anything. They gave us the ability to do it. They gave us the process and the procedures to do it. Let's just follow what they did, and let's take this nation back and put it back on track and become one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Let me see if there's anything else before we move on. Okay. All right. Again, everybody should come to this program and get as many people as they can, your friends, your neighbors, on Saturday the 18th at 1 p.m. Call your friends, your neighbors, other liberty-minded people. Get them to come. They won't be sorry. I think they really enjoy to hear what they got to hear, because I listen to a lot of programs. You know, these people here, those people there. You know, they're trying to do something, okay? And but they tell everybody to get involved, but they don't tell them what to do, what they can do. And people don't know what to do. That's the problem. We are ignorant to the process of our republic. We need to become educated, as Thomas Jefferson said. If the people expect to be ignorant and free, they expect what never was and never will be. So let's take that to heart. Okay, are there any announcements, Jan, or any questions that came into the mail?
Yes, John, I had one announcement, but you've covered it many times. It's for the course Saturday. We have about 14 questions tonight.
Okay, we're not going to take that many. let's take just a couple because I'm running late already. It's 10:30.
Okay, first question. I just found in the California Constitution this section. The Attorney General shall have direct supervision over every district attorney and sheriff in all matters pertaining to the duties of their respective offices.
Null and void. Go ahead. Continue, though.
And may require any of said officers to make reports concerning the investigation, detection, prosecution, and punishment of crime in their respective jurisdictions as to the Attorney General may seem advisable. That's Article 5, Section 13. The question is, am I reading it wrong, or doesn't that mean that when the people elect the sheriff, they're basically electing an employee subservient to the district attorney? If so, that's probably what the municipalities are using to fraud sheriffs into thinking that they have their hands tied by the district attorney. In our original 1849 Constitution, and even the so-called updated 1879 Constitution, the sheriff is only mentioned once, in that the legislature shall provide for their election.
And that's all we need. We need no more to be said in any constitution other than the legislators must provide for their election. The job is already, it's part of natural law, it's part of common law, so it's part of the process, it's part of history. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. Look, at what was read there in that constitution is clearly null and void. Marbury versus Madison, we go right there, null and void. It's repugnant to the Constitution of the United States. It's repugnant to the common law. It denies the common law. And so, therefore, it's repugnant and null and void, and we can nullify it. It's very interesting. I guess the bar lawyers or bar attorneys just don't have enough power. They want some more. I mean, they just don't seem to have enough. So they're going to put bar lawyers, okay, because that's what the attorney generals are. They're all bar lawyers. Bar lawyers are the minions of the New World Order. They're here to just destroy this republic every and any which way they can. A lot of them, of course, don't realize what they're doing because they're ignorant. They're as ignorant as we are, you know? Yeah.
So one of the questions is, then, would the California Constitution be subservient to the federal Constitution?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, let me see if I can get to read this real quickly. Okay. Okay, first of all, in Article 4 of the Constitution, Section 4, it says the United States shall guarantee to the state of this union a republican form of government to every single state. So right there in itself. But there is a powerful one, let's see, which is Article 6, where we read, this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. And anything in the Constitution or the laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. So, yeah, the supreme law of the land is the Constitution of the United States of America. That's the supreme law. Any constitution, any law anywhere that violates, it's null and void. It's as if it never passed. It holds no power, no weight. And that'll never be applied properly in this republic until we, the people, take our courts back. And the only way to take these courts back is to take control of the courts, which we should have been doing from the very beginning. We, the people, need to make sure that we have fully informed jurists. I promise you, if you go read the handbook that we had mentioned, the jurist handbook, okay, if you go read that jurist handbook, you will become fully informed as a jurist if and when you serve as a jurist. And we should all serve as jurists when called upon. But they have to be fully informed. And that's why it's so important that the jury administrators be properly educated, properly informed themselves. They need to know, look, if you don't know the Constitution, how can you make sure that your government is paying attention and applying the Constitution and behaving under the Constitution and not going outside their jurisdiction? How can you know that if you don't know the Constitution? And the Constitution is a very small book. It's not that much to it. Some of the most important parts, we had an individual who had brought this up a couple of weeks back and talking about the preamble to the Constitution. This is the most important part of the Constitution right here, is the preamble to the Constitution. And I'm going to read this. And if you remove this paragraph, you no longer really have a common law constitution. Your Declaration of Independence is sort of no longer the foundation of what we have as law. And it says, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, and here's the key, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. We, the people, are the lawmakers. Our founding fathers put this together when they were party to the Committees of Safety. They were the people governing themselves and creating a nation. And we need, in order to continue this nation, we need to resurrect the Committees of Safety to take control and power within our counties from the grassroots level. If the people are not doing this, someone else is. And I can tell you that every county is being controlled by four individuals. And every state is controlling those four individuals by, you know, you got, like, we have, 62 counties in Dutchess County. So 6, 12, 18, 24 plus, it's over 240, people controlling the counties. And those 240 people are controlled by four other people on the state level. And so on with the states up to the federal level, controlled by four people. The chairman, the assistant chairman, and the secretary and the treasurer. Four individuals really control everything. And, of course, they get their orders down from the New World Order, the powers that be, on who's going to be elected and who's going to be put onto the ballot. And give the choice to the people. You have the choice of the criminal on the right or the criminal on the left, because that's what we get. And we've been getting it pretty much all our lives. Every once in a while, a good person gets in. Rare, though, but that happens occasionally. So, the law of the land is the U.S. Constitution, and we can nullify it in the courts as long as we control the courts. Until we control the courts, we can't do much of anything. Every single jury is stacked. Every single one. Okay? Some of them free themselves and become runaway juries. That's rare, but that happens, you know, because they get so disgusted, that's it. Yeah, they're not going to go along with it, you know? We saw that with that young man that was arrested for trying to defend himself. And they're trying to go after him because he defended himself with a weapon. And it was clear, and the jury saw it clearly. Now, I want to tell you, if they could have controlled that a little more, because all the juries are stacked, and control how that trial went, they could have gotten their conviction on that guy, which he, of course, is not deserving of that. But in any event, they could have gotten that because the juries are stacked. And as a matter of fact, if you go through our courses, when you get into the jurist, the administrative course, you will see clearly that the juries are stacked. We talk a little bit about that and the questionnaires that they give and so on. Everything is structured so that they know the mindset of the person, and they place the right person into the right case so that they can get their conviction. Because that's what it's all about, you know. That's what it's all about for these people. Anybody who bucks the system, they want to put them in jail. And that's what communists do. That's what Nazis do. And that's where we're at. But anyway, we have to take it back. And the seminar is going to lay this all out. That's what this seminar is all about, government by consent. So, okay, I spent a lot of time on that. Let's take one or two more, Jan.
And next question, then. Who can swear in the People's Grand Jury of Loudoun County, Virginia? We will investigate our irrefutable findings of potential election criminality in Loudoun.
Well, look, at the jury, I guess, could be sworn in by the sheriff, of course, but usually it's a judge. I mean, that's kind of the judge's job in that county. And that's the only thing he's involved with that. It could be the magistrate of also, and, you know, all judges are magistrates, by the way. That means a judge can sit in a court of equity, or he can sit in as a magistrate in a court of law, which means that he can only exercise the will of the jury. Okay, he's not to manipulate the jury, and he doesn't get to decide the law, and the jury gets to decide the facts. No, that there is a criminal act right there. No, the judge or a magistrate, usually that's their job to swear him in, and that's just all they get as far as their connection with talking to the jury. When we set things up in the way we're going to go through setting things up, we're looking for the people to take a vow, okay, which includes also obedience to the creator of the universe, coming forward and, and performing our duty with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy. That's the vow. And of course, we talk about the Constitution also. That is to be applied also. I forget exactly the wordage, but we do have it written up on our website in a couple places, and it is in the course for the jury administrator. But if for some reason there's no judge available and the jury has been called, the only people that can call the jury, okay, is the sheriff and the coroner. Those are the two individuals. Now, there are rare cases where people can go and talk to the jury, but that would be civil cases, no criminal cases. If they have a criminal charge to put against someone or some information, they need to go to the sheriff and give it to the sheriff, and the sheriff will investigate it. And if he sees that there's an evidence to a potential crime there, then it's his job to take it to the jury and ask for an indictment. Okay, a bar attorney should never go before and talk to a jury. Never. And that we will prevent. And that's what the people have to do. We have to keep these people out of the hen house, so to speak. The foxes out of the hen house. Because they're destructive and they just want their ham sandwich and they want their conviction. They don't care about innocence or guilt. And they use their indictments often. They'll use their indictments just to get the person to go to jail because they'll say, look, you're facing 20 years here. You know, take a plea, we'll give you 3, and we'll work it out. And that's constantly going on, constantly. That's unlawful. That's unjust. That's evil. So that should not be allowed, and we can't allow that. Of course, the coroner, you know, he goes to a particular place. He sees that there's a situation, something fugazi going on. It looks the criminal. It's his job to take it to the grand jury and ask for a potential indictment if they have the evidence on something. He should collaborate, of course, with the sheriff maybe, because the sheriff can go further investigation, and between the two, they work it out. And either one or the other can go and ask for the, an indictment on an individual. So those are the only two people. And again, the people in certain cases, in the way we're setting things up, which we're setting it up under how the Magna Carta set it up with 4 individuals, and that's why we're looking for 4 administrators in every county. And, the people come with a problem, they can talk with the administrators, they should be able to solve the problem, make a call to the bureaucrat that's causing the problem and require that they obey the law. And of course, if they don't listen to them, then they could take it to the grand jury and allow the person go and explain their problem to the grand jury, and the grand jury can tell them, hey, what they need to do to fix the problem, with the understanding that if you're not going to obey the law, we'll just send you into the trial jury and let them deal with it. So that's a way where people can get in and talk with the grand jury. That should be open to the people, but of course, first, if there's a way to deal with that problem before going that far, it should be dealt with. And the Committee of Safety will play the biggest role in that. People have problems, they go to the Committee of Safety in their county, and the Committees of Safety will have the necessary tools, understanding, and education to be able to deal with the problem and fix it. And if they don't, they can pass it to the jury administrators, and it can go up that line. But it can and will be dealt with, and it will be dealt with justly if the people run it. But as long as we give it back to the fox, we're never going to get justice. All right, I know there's a lot of questions. I'll try to make something short next week and deal with whatever questions we have left, and we'll deal with them then, okay?
Okay.
Okay, thank you. All right, I saw Brent. Brent, are you ready to go? And Gerard, are you ready to go? You guys have to unmute yourself to talk because we're not hearing you. Brent? Gerard? Yeah, we can't unmute them.
Brent.
There goes Brent. Here. Okay, give me a minute, Brent. Let me see if Gerard's here. Gerard?
Okay.
Calling Gerard. All right, well, we'll see if he shows up once you finish up, Brent. You ready to go, Brent?
Yes.
Okay. All right, let me introduce you. This is Brent Allen Winters. He's the author of the book, The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic. And then we'll open up for Q&A.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks. This is Brent. Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. And my comments are my own. May or may not agree with the views of the principal personalities of National Liberty Alliance, but they're kind enough to let me say a few words and have done so for a long time. I appreciate it. Well, I just want to drop a footnote here about the supreme law of the land, Article 6 of our Constitution. I just noticed, I had a friend call me today and said, you made the big time. I said, what are you talking about? I got indicted again? Is that what you're saying? No, no. He said, no, not that. He said, I was watching TV tonight, and there was the blurbs coming across the bottom of the TV screen, and one of them was your trial, the U.S. Constitution on trial with Ted Weiland back in Missouri last year. And this fellow that called me was the one that had videotaped it. He said it's on YouTube now, and they were advertising it. Well, I noticed it only had a few hundred views, but it's monetized. I don't know who's doing it, but they ought to give me a cut. I haven't figured that out yet. But it's up there. And one of the things that came up during that, it was in southeastern Missouri, out in the boonies from Springfield toward Joplin, Missouri, where it was held. Quite a few people showed up. And Ted Weiland has written a book, claiming the Constitution of the United States is an idol, an Antichrist document, etc. So I took the opposite position, of course. And one of the chief points that came up, and I don't think that I, reading the chat of people that have watched the YouTube video, is 3 hours and 17 minutes long. Just type in Ted Weiland, W-E-I-L-A-N-D, or the Constitution on Trial, or Brent and Ted, or something. It'll come up on YouTube with other things, I think, of me talking. But the whole idea of the supreme law of the land came up. And what I discover is, I try to get my point across about what the phrase means, and reading the chat, I'm not convinced I do, but let me take another shot at it. And the reason I say this, what I'm about to say, is because the Supreme Court of the United States has said it, and at that time, a long time ago, 100 years ago, they hit the nail with their head in defining the supreme law of the land. I mean, the Supremacy Clause is an important part of our Constitution. It says that, let me read it here, to not understand these phrases, this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, shall be, all treaties made, it says, and all that, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or the laws of the state to the contrary, notwithstanding, that means nothing will stand up. Nothing in any state will stand up to this idea that our Constitution is the supreme law of the land. Now, our Constitution doesn't really say much about anything that touches our lives directly. It doesn't have any list of laws. It doesn't define murder, larceny. The only crime it defines is treason. It does define that one. That's the only one. It doesn't have any hint about any other crime, of which there are thousands of crimes in the law books of each of the states. In each of the states, larceny had mentioned, of course. Then there's arson, and there's adultery, sodomy. You say, well, those aren't even laws. Oh, they are in some places. they haven't paid much attention, and the Supreme Court, sodomy has always been against the law. It's been a crime in every state, as has been adultery, by the way. Still a crime in many states, and prosecuted as such. If they prosecuted all the people guilty of adultery, and half the country would be in prison, oh, probably more than half. But it's because it's not prosecuted, it's not looked upon as all that dangerous, I suppose. But there's a lot of crimes. None of them are in the Constitution. The Constitution does not address anything about contract law, tort law, the law of estates and trust. And those are the things that touch our lives, and our state courts are filled with actions and lawsuits about those kinds of things. So our Constitution really doesn't say much. But what it does say is extremely important. But the supreme law of the land is what it is. Let me read here what one Supreme Court justice said. Amendment 6th phrase, the supreme law of the land, echoes Magna Carta's words, by the law of the land. This phrase, supreme law of the land, is lifted from Magna Carta. Remember, Magna Carta, the drafter of Magna Carta, the chief drafter, was Stephen Langton. Stephen Langton, the man that gave us our chapter divisions and our Bibles that we use yet today. The Pope of Rome excommunicated him, relegated him to hell for having written it, and anybody that was connected with it, anybody that signed it, including all of the barons, the landholders of England. They were the ones that pushed it. And he wrote it, and he put in there that no man's life, liberty, property, I add, or a combination thereof, shall be taken without, I'm paraphrasing the Latin, without having followed the law, according to the law of the land. The law of the land, that's the phrase. The Latin is lex terra. Terra, like territory, means land, and lex means law. Let me read what he says here. The words due process of law, says the Supreme Court, well, that's another phrase our Constitution has, as you know, were intended to convey the same meaning as the words by the law of the land of Magna Carta. Now we're coming to the key of the definition of what the phrase supreme law of the land means. We're getting there. And the Supreme Court makes this point because it's a matter of studying, just looking into history and seeing what that phrase meant. And the phrase supreme law of the land, or law of the land of Magna Carta, was their phrase for due process of law. It's an old way of saying it. Another way of saying due process of law, watch me close. There have been many, many phrases to communicate this. Another phrase meaning due process of law is the phrase common law. Another phrase in our history of Anglo speech meaning due process of law is the phrase Volkrecht. Volkrecht. Volk is the folk, F-O-L-K. Reicht is right, R-I-G-H-T. It's a Germanic tongue. And so Reicht, you've heard that in the old Nazi movies. The Third Reich. Now, same idea. It's a Germanic word, and what it means is duty. The Volkrecht is our common law. That's the phrase that meant common law to all the people that heard it. So we've got the words common law. We've got the words, well, Volkrecht before that. Common law of the land, our Constitution, supreme law of the land. What does that mean? It means our common law. Well, what is our common law? It is due process. What is due process? It's the way we do things. It's the way we do things. It's not the end result. It's not the outcome standards. Thou shalt not covet, lie, steal, commit adultery, or murder. Those are outcome standards. That's the end result of what you can't do. No matter what else happens, when it's all said and done, that better not be the result. Covet, lie, steal, commit adultery, and murder. Only God has jurisdiction to dictate the outcome result. And he does so in that set of standards we called the Ten Commandments. The last five say, do not covet, lie, steal, commit adultery, or murder. That's not what our Constitution is about. It doesn't have anything in it about coveting, lying, stealing, committing adultery, murdering. The law of estates and trust, the law of contracts, doesn't have anything in there about that. Why? Because it's not about substantive law. It's about process. It's how we go about doing things. And that's what our common law is. Our common law is not about substantive law. It's about how we go about doing things. Let's put it in a, let's use another phrase. Here's another one. We said due process. Let's say fair play. Fair play. A fair fight. Those phrases only exist in the English-speaking world. Why? Because we're the only common law countries in the world. They don't say anything about fair play in France. They don't care about fair play in South America. Fair play. Give him fair play. I think I told the story about the boy. The boy I read about, he was probably 16, 17 years old. And Andy Jackson, you know, he was general officer of the militia of the state of Tennessee. We didn't have a standing army at that time, really. Not much. Maybe a little. Because our Constitution didn't allow it. It's amazing how we get away with all that now. So the state militias were the power. Andy Jackson, we were at war with Britain. He mustered the state militia. People volunteered from Kentucky. And all along the Ohio and the Ohio River on both sides, they came and joined the Tennessee militia. Because he was wanting to go down to New Orleans or what's that other place? Down there, not Biloxi, down there on the coast in Mississippi. Or somebody can maybe clue me in. But he knew the British were going to land at one of those two places, and he got intelligence that somehow they got word that there were large trunks of clothing on board, and they could see the frills and the hems of women's dresses sticking out of them. And they knew the British officers were bringing their wives over to have a shindig in New Orleans. They sure weren't going to have a shindig over in Mississippi. What is that place down there? It's a port. But it's not where you go to have fun like they do in New Orleans. So he said, I'm going to take a chance and march to New Orleans. Well, they got down into the... Somebody just told me the answer, I think. No, maybe not. They got down in the... Biloxi, yeah, that is. Thank you very much. Well, they ended up going to New Orleans on a gamble, hoping that's where the British would land. And sure enough, they did. They got down there in that swampy country. And those fellas from Tennessee and Kentucky and up along the Ohio River, they heard about crocodiles but never seen one. Or alligators, I guess they call them. They're all over down there. They're lizards. They're thick as flies in some places. You can go driving down the road and see them crawling up out of the ditches. I've been down there and seen gators everywhere. Well, they were crossing some swampy stream down there, and this boy from Kentucky, 16, 17 years old, they all got across, and they looked back, and they heard him scream, and they looked back, and they saw his head come up, and then they saw him go down again. And then his head came up, and he went down again. He screamed again. And so they all rushed into the water to try to help him. And when he came up again, and he stayed up a little while, he said, no. He said, give him fair play. He wanted a fair fight, see, with this gator. So he said, give him fair play. I can handle him. I don't want you to help. It ain't fair, he said. Well, he ended up gouging out the gator's eyes with his thumbs. He got his thumbs in his eyes and got one gouged out, and the gator gave up the field and left, turned him loose, and his leg was chewed up a little, but he was okay otherwise. Well, that whole idea of fair play is due process, and it's part of our culture. We even talk that way. They don't talk that way in other countries. We don't stop to consider often enough how different we really are. You talk about freedom. Why are we free people? Because we have this notion of fairness. Do we always do it? No. Does the government do it? Hardly ever. They've lost all sense of fairness. See, the last presidential election wasn't about who we want to be president. The problem was we didn't follow the process. The Constitution gives us the process, the way, the law of the land. And when it says supreme law of the land, that doesn't mean that as Ted Weiland and those other fellows said about me, well, he wants the Bible, the Constitution to supplant and replace the Bible because it says it's supreme law of the land. That means it's supreme. Well, what's the law of the land? It's not just every law. No, it's due process. It's the way we go about doing things. God dictates the end results, the outcomes, the outcome standards, and he has given jurisdiction to us to do things in a fair way. Notice and an opportunity to be heard, a meaningful opportunity to be heard. That's fundamental due process, a fair fight. What's a fair fight mean? The Supreme Court says, has said, back in the 1930s, when it comes to federal prosecutors, U.S. attorneys, hard blows are permissible. Foul blows are not permissible. They've made a science out of it. Well, I want to drop a footnote about that and then talk about a day in the life of a common lawyer. I get telephone calls. People think I have answers. They think I have a silver bullet that I can get them out of their problem. Or they're hoping I do, and I don't blame them. If you're under indictment, the government's taking a hard go at you, unjustly, unfairly. They don't show you the exculpate and the evidence. That's not fair. That's not a fair fight. Our law requires a fair fight. There are ways. That's why we have the Bill of Rights, a public trial, a violations of due process, fairness. That's the biggest thing our Constitution puts forward. That's what our Constitution is. The Fifth Amendment, or the Fifth Article, or the 14th Amendment. It's all about due process of law. Well, what is that? It covers everything. The supreme law of the land is due process. What is there that due process doesn't govern absolutely? We believe in America, that in a common law country, the truth will never bob forth. The truth will never bob forth from the flux of human relationships unless there's a real case and controversy and a real fight. And if you don't stand to lose life, liberty, property, or a combination thereof, our common law says the courts don't even have jurisdiction to hear the case. There's got to be somebody claiming to be bloodied up. Got to be. And our Constitution of the United States says that. Again, it's about how we do things, the supreme law of the land. Well, how do we do things? Well, our common law tradition says the courts don't have jurisdiction unless there's a real case and controversy. That's exactly what our Constitution says. It's called the Real Case and Controversy Clause. And it says that the federal courts, because our Constitution only, first and foremost, pertains to limiting the federal government by the government by the way it says it's got to do things. And one of those ways is the court doesn't have jurisdiction unless there's a real case and controversy. That means concrete. That means somebody's got to be claiming to have lost something, bloodied up somehow. That's in our federal courts. Well, that's the general common law standard. And so when the Constitution says this Constitution is the supreme law of the land, it means it is the trumping card on how we do things. Nothing on how we do things trumps the Constitution of the United States. Well, this fella, one more point, shifting gears a little here. Let me read this is a different story. It's about how things are done, I suppose. This is from the good book. Not a good book. The good book. The Bible. Proverbs chapter 26, verse 17, reading from the Winterized Version of the Bible. The Winterized Version. You want to know what the Winterized Version is? Go to commonlawyer.com and you can see what it is. Commonlawyer.com. Okay, here's the verse. One passing by, meddling with a real case and controversy, not his, is one taking a dog by the ears. One passing by, meddling with a real case and controversy, not his, is one taking a dog by the ears. I heard this verse when I was a boy. Of course, I heard it in the King James, not in the Winterized Version. I had considered translating the Bible at that time. But I heard this verse, and so we had shep dogs. On my father's side of the family were shep dog people. They were from southern Indiana. My mother's side of the family were hound dog people, hunting dogs. They were from the hills of Kentucky. Two different cultures there. I'm a similar in some ways, but not in others. So we had a couple of shep dogs, old Frisk and Laid. We were collie kind of people. They were border collies. And they're border collies. If you've ever been around them, they're gentle, friendly animals. Those are the kind of dogs that can herd chickens and not hurt them, herd sheep and herd cattle, nip at their heels a little, but never, they're not attack dogs. They're very gentle, but they get what they want. And these dogs are friendly to us, and I went outside and sat down on the porch, and old Chris came up, and I petting her on the back of the neck, and I just kind of drew my hands up. I was probably 6 or 7 years old, and I grabbed hold of her ears. Well, it didn't take me long to find out she didn't like that. Now, she was my friend. She didn't try to bite me. A lot of dogs would bite you if you did that. You take a dog by the ears, and you've got trouble on your hands to some degree. Varying degrees depend upon the dog. Dog doesn't like that. The reason a dog doesn't like that, I finally figured out later, because their eyes aren't that good. But their nose and their ears are extremely sensitive. And they live by their ears, and you've seen dogs perk up their ears, and their ears are big, and they pop up in the air, unless they're a hound dog, of course, like mom's side of the family always kept. But they stick up. And they don't like their ears grabbed because that's what allows them to be alert to their environment. Well, this verse says that a man that is passing by and meddles with a real case in controversy that isn't his, well, he's as foolish as a man that takes a dog by the ears. There's no reason to take a dog by the ears. I can tell you for a fact, though. I did try it, and I found out that it doesn't work. Well, here this fellow calls me, and I didn't know him. I always ask the same question. So, isn't it something how people get on the telephone and they refuse to identify themselves? I mean, they're the ones making the call. I'm not bothering them. They're bothering me. And they say, is this Mr. Winters? And I say, yes, but my mother taught me that when I call somebody to always identify myself. Oh, they usually back off, but I found nicer ways to say it. Usually I'll say, with whom do I have the pleasure of speaking? And then they'll tell me, oh, their mothers didn't teach them. Probably their mothers didn't learn it either. Their grandmothers didn't teach their mothers to be polite on the telephone. Of course, the grandmothers, maybe they didn't even have telephones back in those days. I don't know. But it is the polite thing to do. But he called me. We got to talking. I said, where are you from? He's working at an oil refiner, that refinery down in Mississippi, southern Mississippi. I said, where are you from? He said, Upper State, New York. I said, well, where? He said, on up the Hudson River and then off to the west a little bit. Well, I've been up through that country, and I knew a little bit about it. It's beautiful up there, beautiful wilderness is what it is. A lot of mountains people don't know anything about up there. Well, we got to talking. I said, what happened? What's the problem? He said, well, I was driving home from work. He's working at this oil refinery. He travels around and works at oil refineries because he knows how to deal with brazing pipes and pulling conduits apart, and they refurbish these refineries. And he said, I was driving home. I work 12-hour days sometimes. I was driving back to the hotel, and I see two black guys alongside the road, and one's beating the stuffings out of the other one with his fists. I mean, beating him like a red-headed stepchild, apparently. And I said, what'd you do? I said, I stopped. I stopped along the road on the other side, and I got on the telephone, and I called 911 because I thought somebody's going to get killed. I called 911. They said, we'll be right out. Stay in the truck. We'll be right out. We'll send somebody over there. And so he got out of the truck, and he hollered at the two men fighting. One was a young fella, and the older fella was bigger, and he had the best of the younger fella. And he said, lay off. I called 911. The police are coming. Well, here come the big fella toward him screaming at him. Took a swing at this fella. This black guy took a swing at this white guy. So the white guy took a swing back, and he said, I'm not a very big fellow, but I wasn't going to let him swing at me. And he swung at him, and he quit beating on the other fellow. Police show up, and what do?
Excuse me.
Brent,
excuse me. Yeah, just real quick, I got to walk away from my computer, so if you finish before I'm back and Gerard's not here, just either keep talking or you can take Q&A. But I'll be back in about 5 or 10, okay?
All right. Thank you. Anyway, the fellow that was beating the stuffings out of the younger fellow come at this white fellow that stopped and called 911 and took a swing at him. And the white boy, he described how big he was, and that's not very big, but he said, I took a swing back at him. And then he said the cop showed up. And as soon as the cop showed up, get this. Now, here's we're getting to the climax of the story. Both of these black guys started screaming that the white guy was a racist and had attacked them and assaulted them. True story. So who gets arrested? Well, the white guy. Now, let me go back here. And he got prosecuted for a crime. Now, let me go back here and read this verse again. Proverbs 26:17. One passing by, was he passing by? Yeah, he was passing by. He was coming back to the hotel from work, and he saw these two black fellas fighting. He's passing by, and he stopped, and he meddled with a real case and controversy. Listen, when two men are trying to beat a mud hole in each other, and then turn around and beat it dry, that's a real case and controversy. They're standing to lose life, liberty, property, or a combination thereof. You don't think your life hidden property? It is. Life, liberty, or property. Those are all kind of different forms of the same thing. Well, it was a real case in controversy. So we're running it through the standard here. He said, Solomon speaking, anybody passing by meddling with a real case in controversy that isn't his is like a man taking a dog by the ears. I read this to him, or kind of recited the idea to him from Proverbs here. He laughed. He said, yeah, you'd think a fellow would learn his lesson. I said to him, I'm the one that called 911. What are you trying to throw me in jail for? I wasn't doing the beating. Come to find out, the older man that was beating the younger man, that was his son. Who knows what was going on? But I know this. If you're passing by and you see that kind of thing going on, don't meddle with it. Matter of fact, the lady on the telephone, or the dispatcher, told him, stay in the truck. And you say, well, he was afraid somebody was going to get hurt, so he told him to stop fighting. He called 911. The cops would be there soon. He thought that'd break him up. Well, didn't work that way. Isn't it amazing, though? It is to me. I continue to be amazed at how applicable the laws of nature's God are. The Bible, the laws of nature's God. It's the meaning of that phrase in our Declaration of 76. Well, as it turned out, they wanted him to plead to a misdemeanor of assault. Apparently that was the law in Mississippi. And then they wanted him to take anger management classes. They wanted him to take classes on drugs and alcohol. He said, I've never smoked a joint in my life. I've only been drunk once or twice when I was a teenager. He said, I don't have a drug and alcohol problem. He said, well, if you want the counseling, you can take it. He said, no, I'm not taking it. What about anger management? We think you ought to take that because you got an anger problem. That's why you were in that. He said, no, I wasn't angry. The guy attacked me. Well, if you want this plea bargain, you got to take the anger management. Listen, stay away from the government. Do not meddle with controversies that are not yours. Here's what will happen. This happened to him. The reason they want you to take drug and alcohol counseling when you're accused of a crime is so that they can accuse you of having a drug and alcohol problem later when you try to purchase a firearm, or later when they want to take your firearm from you. That's what that's all about. I've watched it over the years. That's the way it works. The reason they want you to take anger management counseling is so that later, if they need to or want to, for whatever reason, they can say, you've got an anger problem. Here's the proof of it. You admitted it. You said you needed anger counseling, anger management counseling. And then they'll take your guns from you. That's what that's all about. He said, I didn't know that. I said, yeah, that's what that's all about. And here he is trying to do community service, and he can't do it and work at the same time. What a mess. What an unbelievable mess. Well, if you haven't had this problem yet, you're fortunate. But it's better to know the standard. If you know this standard here, this just this one, you can keep a fellow out of a whole boatload of trouble and problems and confusion that just drags and hangs on you like molasses. Well, this is Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. And you can go to the website and join our next course. We just taught the course on sheriffs. The Sheriff at Common Law, 12 weeks. Sheriff Darlee from Berry County, Michigan, taught the class with me, and I think we're going to start, scheduled to start a new class on the 6th of January concerning the grand jury. I'm hoping Sheriff Darlee joins me in teaching that class too. Now, in the meantime, there was a question a while ago, unless John or Gerard are back, and they may, if they are, they can pipe in and I'll stop. They can give me a breather. But somebody asked a question about the sheriff, and the comment was made that the word sheriff isn't found in certain constitutions and what people think are the Constitution. And it's not found in the United States Constitution of 1787. It's not there. The word's not there anywhere. Though you say, well, if the word isn't there, why do we say the words constitutional sheriff? Well, the reason we say the words constitutional sheriff are more than one. One reason is many state constitutions include the sheriff as an office, as a constitutional office. That means an act of the legislature can't get rid of the sheriff. That's what that means. So a sheriff is often constitutional in that way. Another way a sheriff is constitutional is he refuses, as sheriff, to violate people's constitutionally protected, that's the best way to say it, by the way, not constitutional rights, because the Constitution doesn't give them to us. But they are constitutionally protected rights, and that's the phrase our courts have used for decades and decades and decades, constitutionally protected rights. The sheriff is sworn not to violate anyone's constitutionally protected rights, including due process of law. So we call him constitutional sheriff for that reason. But there's even a bigger reason than those two, and that's two big reasons. The biggest reason is this, because the sheriff, the office of sheriff is so ancient, the only office in our common law tradition, more ancient in our records that we have of our existence as a common law people, going clear back to the island of Britain and clear back to the north of Europe, the only office that we can trace any further back than sheriff is the office we call king. King! And in the early days, a king was just a tribal leader that had no power until the elders, the Witengemot, that means the meeting of the white-bearded men, until they delegated war powers to him. That's the only function the king really had, was the war power function to lead the Volkreich, the folk, doing their duty, the militia, we would say, or later they said in British England, they said the furred fair, the militia going. The only power the king had was when the body of elders declared war. Well, we have that same tradition in our Constitution of the United States. The President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, only has the power to wage war, according to our law, as if the Congress of the United States, the assembled body of elders, declares war. Then he has the powers of commander-in-chief, war powers. Yep. That's our common law tradition. It's always been that way. Our Constitution, you see, is a brief of common law government, due process. It's not do this and don't do that. It's not outcome standards like the Ten Commandments. It is how we go about doing things. Well, how do we go about waging war? There's a process. Congress has to declare war first. We haven't been paying much attention to that since World War II, but that's what it's supposed to be. Again, just to say, the Constitution of the United States is a common law document. It's a brief of common law judgment. What is the common law? It is due process. That's what it is. What's the other phrases for due process through the history of the solid stepping stones of our common law tradition? Magna Carta, for instance. Lex terra, land law, the law of the land. That means due process. That's their old phrase for due process. Our Constitution lifts that out, supreme law of the land. That's the trumping way, W-A-Y, the process, the course we follow in doing things. Again, one more time, just to say it so it's clear. There's nothing in our Constitution about tort law, contract law, family law, estates and trusts. There's not even any standards in there or any discussion of admiralty law. It just says that the general government in Washington, D.C. has admiralty jurisdiction, and the courts have admiralty jurisdiction when admiralty cases come up. That's the way we do things. We're the powers. Who's got the power? For instance, the Constitution says no state legislature has the authority to impede or alter the terms of private contracts. No state legislature. But then it gives bankruptcy jurisdiction to the federal courts. The federal courts have power to alter, abrogate, impede contracts. As a matter of fact, that's what bankruptcy is all about. Contract protection, so you don't have to pay your debts. See, the Constitution doesn't say what the result is going to be in any of those cases. It doesn't say who's going to be president, but it does say here's how you go about it, and if you don't go about it this way, then the result is invalid. Joe Biden, by that standard, is not president of the United States, clearly. Why? Because the process the Constitution said we had to follow, we didn't follow. That's the point of due process. I thought I heard somebody there. Gerard, are you there? Well, neither John. Is John there?
Well, I'm here when you're ready. I'm here whenever you're ready.
Well, I was going to open it up and say, John, John's here, but open it up. If there are questions, then.
Okay.
Then,
all right. Are you done then?
Be entertained. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. All right, and if you want to pipe into any of these questions, you're welcome to do so. So, okay, Gerard, are you here? Thank you, Brent. Gerard, are you here? I guess he's not here, so we'll just go to the open forum. If anybody has any questions or comments, star 6 and a 1 to get into the queue. We do have a few people in the queue. Star 6 and a 1, questions or comments. Let's take Fareed, California. Go right ahead. You got the mic.
Yeah, hi. Good evening. Thanks again for all you do, everyone. Regarding Committee on Safety, in Santa Clara, I wonder. I know some people who are active, just like myself, who are members of NLA. But I wonder if there is a forum where we could connect locally so that we could increase our momentum in doing whatever we want to do as a
Local
community.
Yeah, you can go up to the website here, and let me see if I remember where it's at. I believe it's under People's Duty, and you can come down and find, let's see, come a minute, I'm looking for the page where you can connect or see if a Committee of Safety has been created. It should be under People's Duties. Let me see if I could find. Okay, here it is. Under Committee of Safety, People's Duty, Committee of Safety, and you roll over to, find your county Committee of Safety. So if you click on that, And you're in California, right?
Yes.
Okay, so let's see if we'll start in California for you, see if there's anybody that's started anything in your county yet. So we'll go to California.
So what
And then what county are you in?
Santa Clara.
Santa Clara. Okay, no one has started one in Santa Clara. How do you spell that? C-L-A-R-A? Clara?
Santa, S-A-N-T-A, Clara, C-L-A-R-A.
Okay, no one has started one here, so you could take that opportunity and then, you know, become a leader for Committee of Safety. I'm looking to see where. I don't know, is Carl here? I'm not sure where to sign up on this. Well, Jan, do you know where to sign up on this as a as an individual trying to organize Committee of Safety in their county?
John, I don't know where you sign up, but I can tell Fareed.
I think it's moved, John.
I can tell Fareed who's in his county. I can send him a list.
Yeah,
okay. So if I guess we got your phone number here, so you want to just give him a call tomorrow and get his email or whatever?
I've got his email. Thank you.
Okay, great. All right, meanwhile, we will look for that because there's supposed to be a way. Were you saying something, Jan? Is there a way to do that? Because we're in the state right now. I'm looking at the counties that are in effect, and there should be a button here to sign up as a, you know, to organize a committee of safety.
Yeah, the last time I looked, John, I couldn't find it. I think it had been removed.
Okay, well, we need to get it back, and people should be able to download contact of people, actually anywhere within the states, but not in the first name, county, and phone numbers. So you can call the people up and have a conversation with them to see if they want to work together. You know, I know up here where I'm at, there's quite a few counties that connect, so to speak, and we go to each other's meetings. It's been a while since I've been too active locally, but that still goes on. People visit each other's meetings. So now we're going to be pushing the committees of safety. And, you know, you could start a committee of safety and build it together with other counties. And as they get enough people, then they can kind of get a thing going in their own counties. So however you can organize and work together with other people, not only in your own county, but in other counties around you, because that's what you're eventually going to be doing anyway, connecting with other counties from time to time.
Right. Okay, we'll do it. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's take our next question. We've got Jim from Pennsylvania. You got the mic, Jim. Go right ahead.
Yeah, good evening. It's Jim in Pennsylvania. I wanted to know if, John, if you were available for speaking with the John Birch Society, or Gerard, or even Brent, if it's...
Oh, I'd love to go speak to the John Birch Society.
We have not said it yet, but it would be in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in February.
I could make it there. Gerard and I both could probably make it there together.
Okay, well, then I'll work on that. I'll stay in touch with you, and we'll make it work.
Try to get me as much time as possible so we can really lay some... groundwork with them down, because those are people that are active and understand the problem, and you know, they should be able to really be excited about what we have to offer.
Yeah, okay, well, I'll work on it. I'll get back to you just as soon as I can, but I do have a question.
Mm-hmm.
It says that the one of the duties of Congress was back at the beginning of this country, whereas they were to shall be for the Washington, D.C., and I believe Brent commented on Washington, D.C., in some casual comment about for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question is, was that ever meant for the residents, to reside in those 10 square miles?
Repeat that question. I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay. Congress created the 10 square miles known as
Washington. Right, and that, of course, is Washington, D.C. But so what you're thinking is, the question is, should people or do people live there, or should they be living? Is that your question?
Yes.
Well, I guess there's not a problem with that. I don't see a problem with it. Do you?
Well, I thought it was for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, stockyards.
Well, that's not just... No, well, that 10 square miles is for the seat of government. Then they have the... Then, of course, they have other properties scattered throughout the United States where they would have those kind of things, docks and places for armaments and so on and so forth. And so that there's lots of places that are that. Or every fort, for instance, is a place of that nature.
Can I add something?
Sure, go right ahead.
It's 10 miles square. So that's 100 square miles, not 10 square miles. It's 10 miles square, not 10 square miles.
No, I don't think so. You talk about what the Constitution says?
Well,
the Constitution says
Washington,
that it's
D.C.
is 10 miles square.
10 miles square, not 10 square miles.
Well,
it's
that's
10
true.
Miles on a side.
Right. Well, again, you know, it's 2 times 5, 2 miles one way, 5 miles another way, however it's shaped, so on and so forth. But that's for the seat of government, okay? There is an additional allowance for that, and I think that is actually listed in Article 1, Section 8 also, I think. You can find that in there where it has the rights to put forts, docks, you know, different... necessities for federal government and to store weaponry, I guess, and so on. I mean, again, there's forts scattered throughout the whole United States. And there's docks, you know, I know there's the Navy dock, I forget what they call it, it's been so long, many, many years, but down in Brooklyn there's the Navy docks. So, does that answer your question? Because
oh, yeah.
I wouldn't really...
It says specifically not exceeding 10 miles square.
But that is for the seat of government.
Yeah, and I always thought people were living in a warehouse if they lived in D.C.
Well, they don't. A lot of people work in D.C., so they do need a place to stay and be.
Yeah.
You know? So
a lot of people work downtown Pittsburgh, but they don't live down there.
Well, that's true. You know, you can live outside of that that... Washington, D.C., you go right across the river there. What's that, the Delaware River, and there's plenty of places you can live right outside. So, in Maryland.
Okay,
so, and Jim, further away.
I just wanted to invite Brent Gerard and you, John, to the Speaking Bureau. We're going to get it established, and we'll get back to you just as soon as I can. That's all I have. I yield.
All right. Again, try to get us as much time as possible so we can lay out the plan to them, you know. So I'm willing to travel to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let's take our next caller. Let's take Thomas. You got the mic. What state are you from, Thomas? Thomas, you got the mic. Did we lose Thomas? He was up there. So
I think I'm here now.
There you go. We can hear you. Go right ahead.
I saw the mic. Thank you so much for taking my earlier question about the grand jury in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
We have, I don't know what the decorum is on the call here, and I don't know how private it is.
Now, any question, any comment on anything, you know, if you have any corrections or anything to offer, whatever you have.
Okay, well, I look forward to being an administrator.
Okay.
And I have enough people to call a grand jury here in Loudoun County, and we have documented proof of criminality in our elections.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is it's self-proving and irrefutable evidence. And so we are intent on bringing people to justice, and we are not going to get that help from the communist people that have been installed here in Loudoun County by George Soros.
Mm-hmm.
So we have resolved ourselves that the only way that we're going, and I'm just grateful for your book and the information you guys are putting out. It's like a miracle to me.
Mm-hmm.
But we really need... We have a new attorney general who says he's willing to prosecute, and we have a writ of quo warranto case. If anyone's willing to help us review that, And we have a commitment from the new Attorney General, Jason Miaras, to take a look at it. But frankly, that does not fix what's going on in the counties here in Virginia. It's a mess.
I wouldn't put too much faith in the Attorney General because, again, they're bar attorneys. They've been in this game for a long time, and they are, you know, they are really part of the system.
Yes,
but the key thing is this. The key thing is you don't need to get a hold of the Attorney General to do this. You really need to work with the sheriff because the sheriff is the one that has the power and the authority to call the grand jury. And of course, you know, by calling the grand jury, he would request, of course, someone within the courthouse, which would be the administrators, particularly in this case, it would be the paralegal administrator, one for every county. That's the person who would then call the grand jury by lot. I was just going through reviewing some of the questions and things for the administrative course, and one of the things I was looking at just recently was the essay on the trial by jury. And the note is made here, you know, he makes the note that everybody in the state, every qualified individual that's in the state should be on the list. So we should accumulate whatever list we can to in order to call the grand jury. You know, you can use the motor vehicles, you can use the voters' roll, and I'm sure many, many other things. It used to be the telephone book. I don't think that exists anymore.
So, John,
But let me make a few points by some of the things you had mentioned, and then we can talk some more. One of the things you had mentioned was that you're able to call a grand jury. We got to be careful that we ourselves don't stack a grand jury either. We get like-minded people. What we're setting up is administrations for the grand jury. When we first started this, we were thinking, well, let's form grand juries in every state and so on. And as we started to research and put things together, we realized that that would be a wrongdoing. Matter of fact, out in California, there's a group of people that have formed a grand jury. They've been sitting grand jury for many, many years. Same people, okay, and the same foreman. I mean, that's not the way the system's supposed to go. But what we're doing is we're getting four administrators, actually five, because there's a paralegal. We need four administrators and one paralegal secretary. Who would also, again, be an administrator and fill in from time to time that position. And, of course, the administrators would assist the paralegal in different things, whatever is necessary to perform the necessary duties. But they need to call forth a grand jury, and then they have to be fully informed. Now, if you read through the jurist book that we were looking at just a little while ago,
yes,
matter of fact, it's right here back on the screen.
Yes,
the Grand and Petit Jury Handbook. If you read through that, it's 38 pages.
Yes.
And basically, the orientation will be built around this very handbook. We're going to create a series of videos, PowerPoint videos, and also some ideas of conversation for the jury. We get 8 hours to orientate them. And so when they come in, we need to bring them to become a fully informed jurist. When they walk out of there, they're going to have a whole different mindset on how things work. And so every jury that you pull together has to be the same. It has to be by lot. In other words, you're pulling a sort of the short string or the long straw or whatever it is. And the only disqualifications of a jury, which we need to make a list of. I mean, some of them are obvious. I mean, if the person knows the defendant, obviously they can't sit as a jurist, you know. If they're prejudiced to maybe the religion or the ethnicity of the individual, I mean, just obvious questions, obvious things that would disqualify them. But what religion they are, what news they watch, what persuasion they are, you know, politically, sexually, or whatever, that's none of our business. But if you read the questionnaires in a lot of these different states, and especially in the federal level, I was just looking today at one of the state questionnaires. I think it was New York, as a matter of fact. I mean, it's just absurd, the questions that they ask. And then you have the lawyers come up, and they try to, you know, use the questionnaires and say, ask them a few questions and have them disqualified, maybe because they watch Fox instead of CNN. It's literally that bad, okay? If you look at the questionnaires, it's obviously literally that bad. And, you know, they may even go down a road to ask other questions. No, hey, listen, Everybody that is capable of being a jurist should be on the list. They should be chosen. And unless a certain criteria of questions that they answer that would disqualify them, we have to be very careful in what that might be. And that's it. You know, you can't stack a grand jury. So we have to be very, very careful with that. We also have to be, as administrators, very, very careful not to influence them. Okay, we may do that unwittingly, not realizing that we're influencing them. So we have to be very careful, and we have to police ourselves. You know, it is five people working this job, so to speak, and we need to police each other to make sure that we operate with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy, and we don't fall involved to become stacked by stacking a jury, and or influence a jury in the decision, or trying to. You know, when we write their papers, whatever their will is, whatever the decision is, we have to be careful we don't add to that and make sure that is the final decision of the jury, because they get not only to decide the facts and the law, they also get to decide the restitution, the punishment involved. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So it's all up to them. So I know there's a lot of corruption, and I know you'll get a fully informed jury, grand jury, and you will get the indictment, no doubt about it, because of all the corruption that's in the government. The people have had it up to here. They're already seeing it. They're already knowing it, so most people know it. But remember, you know, when you pull 25 people together, because that's what's required to pull a grand jury, is 25, you only need 12. 12 of the 25, okay, has to say, hey, yeah, there's something wrong here. Let's send it into the courts for a trial. So we, you know, we'll assist you in that process if you want to be an administrator, and you need to get certified. You need to take all our courses, the most important course at the end, of course, and you could take it in the beginning. You can take this course at any time if you feel, look, for people who have a basic understanding of things, basic understanding of the law, you know, the real law, the Constitution, the basic understanding of our history, a basic understanding of who we are as a people, our heritage, and the common law. I mean, they can jump right in and take the administrator's course right away if that's what they want to do. But they're still going to have to go back and take all the other courses and to be totally qualified. That is going to be the hardest course. I wrote these courses and tried to keep them very, very simple all the way through, at least the questions at the end of each chapter, because really people spending time with this is really what we want, you know, just spending time with the information that we're giving, the education. But when it gets down to the administrators, now we're getting hardcore. Everybody, these people really have to know and understand and perform their duty. You know, we can't just put anyone in there. But anyone could become qualified. Anybody could pass the course as long as you have the will. You know, where the will is, the way will always follow. Just be dogmatic about it, and you'll get through it. Doesn't matter. Yes. You know, we become experts in many things just by spending time in things. For instance, we all speak, you know, in our case, it's English language, but we all speak the same language. And we didn't go to school to learn to speak, you know, but we're just around it all the time, and you just pick it up. And same thing with subject, any subject matter. You know, you try to understand something, you need not remember anything. Just try to understand it, because once you understand it, you'll never forget it. And it's like a piece of the puzzle. As you're puzzling through these things, you start to get the big picture. Courses are required. Certification is required. Yes. And you should do that right away, anybody who wants to do that, because time is short and we're ready for things to happen, I think.
Yes. You'll see me doing that. I'll probably take the administrator course first, and I want my vote.
Yeah, I expect we're going to have that up. I hope we will by the 18th, which is this Saturday. I just got to get a hold of Carl now and go through posting it up online. And I should be able to get it up in one day. I'm just about done. I just got some more questions to put together on that for the testing as you go through. It's, you know, just like going to school. You get a textbook and read through the chapter, and at the end of the chapter you have questions.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. I'm currently studying for my PhD in Christian ministry and pastoral counseling, and I cannot not do this and be a student of the administration of grand jury. I can't not do it. I don't see another way of getting these this evidence to court other than a presentment. And I will have
Well, again, you know, we, part of this whole process of what we're doing is educating the sheriff, too. Okay, remember, the sheriff is the guy that's got to go and bring it to the jury. And that's key importance here.
We have we will have our second meeting with Sheriff Chapman of Loudoun County. He's a constitutional sheriff here in Loudoun County.
Are you working through the Committee of Safety Handbook?
Well, I've read parts of it, and I'm just getting educated on it. But we've, you know, I formed a group that's statewide where we've actually gone in with what we call strike teams and talked to electoral boards in 30-some counties. We've talked with
doing that, and you can continue to do that. People shouldn't stop whatever they're doing if as long as it's just and right, then just keep doing it. But they also should form committees of safety within the county, because that's where the power comes from. That's where the authority comes from. It comes from the people. And there's a connection with the Committee of Safety with all things, because they're the ones that create everything and prepare everything and assist people in many, many ways. They control the political process, 100% control of the political process. They take 100% control of the court system, as far as courts of law are concerned, by pulling forward the juries. And you got to work with your sheriff. And there is a plan on approaching the sheriff. Maybe you got a sheriff that's working along with you already. But look, that sheriff has to become educated in the common law. And
I bought him one of your books, and we have a meeting with him. My question to you, sir, is...
Well, let me ask you a question. Did you give him the book yet?
Not yet. It's still wrapped. He's going to get it in the meeting. And
okay, well, send me your mailing address.
Yes.
Send it to mail, M-A-I-L, at National Liberty Alliance. Do that tonight if you can, and I'll get out tomorrow. There are two letters that we send out to sheriffs inside. We put it inside the book. One is from Sheriff Darr. And he introduces the book and what we're doing. And one is from National Liberty Alliance, and we introduce to him the book and what we're doing. And we also get a shipping label which has a paragraph or so on it, and speaking about the book, that this book is the property of the sheriff's office. So that when you give it to the sheriff and he leaves office at some point in time, that book needs to stay there for the next sheriff. That's the point.
Sure.
So
sure.
If you send me when are you going to meet with him?
I don't have the exact date, but it will be within the next week or two. And
okay, if you get me your snail mail tonight or tomorrow, I will get it in the mail tomorrow. You'll have it in a couple of days. I mean,
yeah,
I can get the letters for the download easily, but the sticker to be put inside the book, that you have to have.
I will be ordering these books by the case, because I have, like I said, I have a statewide organization of We the People that have gathered together and are working. But the question I have for you, is there a committee of safety in Loudoun County?
Okay, and what state are you in again?
Loudoun County, Virginia. We're the epicenter of all the communist crap that's going on with education, critical theory. We've had our elections stolen. We have rogue supervisory boards. We have rogue clerk of courts. We have a rogue county attorney. And we have a rogue registrar.
L-O-U-D-O-N-D-O-U-N?
L-O-U, that's it.
Okay, you got two individuals working on that.
I know Woody. I know him. He's on my team.
Okay, and listen, it's extremely important that we be uniform across the nation, okay? There is a process that we put together, and the job of the Committee of Safety requires education in different areas, and not one person needs to know it all, but some people have to focus in on the judicial process, some people have to focus in on the political process, some people have to focus in on education. You know, there are subcommittees involved, and we lay this whole thing out, and that's going to be a lot of what we're going
to
be talking about.
I will talk to Woody, because I know Woody. He's dealing with the death of his impending death of a brother right now, so he hasn't been around much in the last 3 months because he's taking care of his family.
Uh-huh.
So, but I do know, I know Woody very well, I just, all I see is just Woody. So the answer is no. There's no committee of safety, correct?
Well, these people are taken on the opportunity of creating one.
I will go through your materials, and I want to do it by the book. I want to do it the right way.
Yeah, it is extremely important that you don't leave nothing out, because the Committee of Safety has to take total control to have government by consent, and there's a lot of different facets to this thing.
Yeah,
so
don't you worry about
it. Put it
sir.
Together. We have to set a resolution up for let me go to the page here that we have on people's duties here, and.
John, while you're looking for that, I'm sorry, I missed the gentleman's name because I'm dealing with another issue right now, but if he just sends a message, an email to mail@National Liberty Alliance tonight or tomorrow morning, and to my attention, and I will get Catherine in touch with him. We have a committee of safety back in Virginia, but I can't tell you what county. So.
Yeah, and if you can maybe give them a list of contacts for everyone within the state, because we won't be giving you emails. We'll just be giving names and phone numbers and counties. That's it.
That's fine.
Because we don't want people to come in and then start sending all kinds of stuff through email. If they give you their email, then that's fine. You know what we did is I set up a meetup group. Let me see where that's at. I think it's here. I set up a meetup group, and we talk about that in the book also, which is a good way to communicate with people and get people involved. Right now, I just recently set this up and started to get active with this. We got 16 members, and we have events. You know, we just had an event recently, and the next event coming right now is I just put this up today, an online event seminar on government by consent. So, everyone should get a meetup group going, only because there's so many great tools on this. You can communicate with people. You can send messages to people. You can post all kinds of stuff and information and connect also with National Liberty Alliance.
Yes.
I mean, there's lots of stuff and things you could do.
Yes, yes.
But going back to the to the handbook, for instance, did I lose a page? I guess I did. Let me go back. Going back to this other page, let me go here again.
Under
people's duty, and you click on handbook. This is extremely important that you follow the process of putting everything together. There's the Committee of Safety handbook.
Every one of those documents. And
because the charter and the resolution and the vow is very important.
Yeah, I have all those downloaded. I will be sharing them with my team. I have a board. We've been organizing for a year, not quite a year, and we are very serious about having free and fair elections in the state of Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's the mother right. So we have, according to Tim Meisberger, who's run elections for USAID for 40 years, says that Virginia is more of a mess than anywhere any third world country he's ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's
we are
probably true of most places. Come to New York.
On doing this according to the book. I'm a man of character, and I'm a man of the book. The book that your earlier speaker spoke of, the good book, the Bible. So I'm not going to waver off of
the United States is built upon that book.
Yes, sir. I understand, and I've highly cherish. I was breaking the binding on this book that I got of yours that you authored. When I got to the middle of the book, there was the 13th Amendment being removed from the Constitution, and that right there set off something that will not be quenched. And I'm very, very, very grateful.
The Bar Association must go completely 100%, and anybody who retains themselves in the bar needs to resign. Judges, prosecutors, anyone, because the purpose of the bar is to destroy the republic. Period.
Yep,
and that is so clear, and I can lay that case out in the court of law without a problem and make it crystal clear to anyone who listens in. They could not destroy the case I would be able to lay out.
So 4 months ago, I created a covenant. It looks like a little miniature constitution. I have signatures in red. People who have given their blood covenant to uphold the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Federalist Papers, the Declaration of Independence, and we are committed as patriots, as Christians, to have our Constitution reinstated, reinstalled, whatever you call it. But I've got meetings with the registrar, the sheriff, the clerk of courts here in Loudoun County. It has been an epicenter of socialist activity, and we are intent on taking back our constitutional republic in the state of Virginia, in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So I'm just, any help I can get, I will send an email tonight to the mail at, I'm Thomas.
And in the same email, just also put your mail, your physical mailing address, so I can mail that stuff out to you to be put in.
I will. I'm Thomas, the one that asked the question about who can call a grand jury. We need one, like ASAP.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever that process needs to be, it needs to be, and however long it takes.
Bear in mind, in times of emergency, you know, look at the Magna Carta. They called themselves, okay? So the people themselves can call the grand jury. So what you're doing is lawful, but I don't think it's going to go anywhere in today's environment. That's the problem. And, you know, not that you shouldn't try. I mean, you could try, but the bottom line is you could continue in the proper process and set things up. And if you fail through that, at some point you get to the other side, now you're going to be able to execute it and deal with it.
I have a report that's worthy of being considered a presentment. I just don't have a people's grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
And I live close to Trump National. My goal would be to have my first meeting at Trump National in the boardroom. I live like three blocks from there.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
So it would be pretty symbolic. Mm-hmm. But
absolutely.
If we talk to Chapman, he's a politician. We've met with him. We've had beers. We talked with him at Belmont Country Club. He's a decent guy, but he's a politician. He's now on the transition team of the governor, so he's going to be doing his politicking while we need our vote. So I want to talk to someone in your organization, John, who can help direct me, because if I have to swear in my own people, I will follow these rules, every single rule you've got here that makes sense and that is biblical and is constitutional. I will follow every single thing because I don't want anyone questioning our motivation.
Well, absolutely. And bear in mind, though, the people, you know, look, we just set the framework up. There's a lot to be added to these things, and people have to figure that out, and every county has their own problems and situations and focuses and you know, so you'll work all that out from the grassroots level, and that's the important part. It comes from the grassroots, from the people themselves.
All right. So, well, thank you.
But make sure you make it to Saturday if you can, seminar, and get the word out to all these other people that are involved with you. They should hear what we have to say, because we're going to be covered. This is a subject we're going to be talking about, government by consent.
I will ask them, and I will get as many there as I can, and now that I have them engaged, there'll be several of them that will get engaged on an ongoing basis,
and you could start working on phone calling these people if you want. As soon as you get that list, I'm sure you know Francine will get it out to you quickly, and you can, you know, a lot of these people may be inactive, and now is the time to activate them.
I will call them. I that's what I prefer. I'm an old schooler, so a name and number is fine.
Yeah, it definitely works better than emails. Emails will support a system ongoing, but to create things and get things going, you have face-to-face, person-to-person, and the real business needs to be done face-to-face, person-to-person.
100%.
So, okay, let me move on to the next caller, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's see. Our next caller is that Kellogg from ID, Indiana, I guess?
Yeah. Are you there?
Go right ahead. You got the mic.
All right. My name is Christopher from Shoshone County, Idaho.
Uh-huh.
And I signed up with you guys like 3 years ago, and just kind of out of desperation, I got my kid taken from me unlawfully. And I was really surprised you called me back like the next day, and I had to turn you down because it was I was like overwhelmed trying to get my kid back, and I was just starting to get into the actual law.
How did things work out with that? I
ended up losing her. We lost custody of her, and we lost our parental rights. and it was all under fraud. It was baloney from the beginning. But
did we file papers for you, or did we connect with you in any way?
No, I just kind of gave up on it at that point. I got an attorney.
If you want, get a hold of us through intake at nationallibertyalliance.org, okay, and Jim will connect with you and talk with you about it. And if you want to put some papers together, we'll do a habeas corpus and we'll put it in. Now, it may not go anywhere right now, but you see, once it's on the record, we got hundreds of cases that haven't gone anywhere, but it's all on the record, ready to go. Once we get to the other side, we're pushing for enforcement.
Yeah, that would be great. I wish I would
have lost their homes. We're going to be pushing for restitution. These people need to be restored. They were unlawfully taken. They need to be given back, or at least a proper compensation for their homes need to be given to these people.
I wish I would have been in a place in my own mind that could have taken advantage of this years ago. But,
we've had a few successes with the habeas corpuses, but mostly not. But again, we do intend and expect to get justice for these people at some point. So anybody that is in a situation that they need a habeas corpus, in your case, you need a habeas corpus for your children, okay? Habeas corpus, or if they've lost their homes or in the process of losing their homes through non-judicial foreclosures, and they're all non-judicial foreclosures. Even though it appears to be going through a court, it's not going through a court. No judge is going to sign the final papers. Nothing is going to be sworn to. They're just going to rob your house through a process that they run. And the more you battle and resist these people, the years can roll by before they actually take your home away. And so you can really hold them back for quite some time. But I do think that we're going to be pushing to the courts of justice, hopefully the beginning of this next year coming up in January, February, hopefully soon. Let's put it that way. We're going to get to the other side. Devolution is in play, and it's just a matter of time.
Well, that kind of touches on one of my questions I had for you. Can you use this grand jury deal to target specific individuals like a caseworker?
Well, yeah, look, if they broke the law, if they went outside of their jurisdiction, and they have, okay, you'd go after all of them. I mean, I'm getting ready to deal with a town court because of a traffic situation, and I'm just tired of it. And so I'm not paying no more tickets to them. And they got me on a couple occasions, and it's all been building up for quite some time because I refused to go to their court with a mask. But in any event, I was thinking about it recently. If they deny me of due process and I pull them into federal court, I'm not just only going after the judge, I'm going after the town itself, because they are complicit in putting these courts together to send swarms of agents, officers, in order to eat out our substance through code violations. Yeah. And so they're all guilty. They're all part of the same thing. So I hit them all. When I went after the IRS, I went after the agents, I went after the commissioner, and numerous other parties in order to prevent any action against me to take place while I was in the court. So,
well, this whole thing started with one cop who declared my daughter in imminent danger when she was sleeping in her mother's arms peacefully in the hospital. And it's the safest place in the world for a child is the hospital in his mom's arms, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, again, talk to Jim if you want, and we'll assist you with the habeas corpus. And how old is the child, and how long have they been away from it?
She's 3 years old now. We fought for 3 years, and they had me take a paternity test at the very beginning of the case.
Yeah, get your affidavit. Go talk to Jim. Get an affidavit together. Right. We'll help to set the stage for the process of getting your daughter back. And again, it will be on. There's no doubt in my mind or heart that this won't happen as we move over to the other side after devolution plays out. And
well, I had another question. I wanted to take advantage of trying to become an administrator,
mm-hmm.
and I'm curious: is there like a cost to all this?
No. Everything we do is free. Everything we teach is free, with a few exceptions. I mean, I wrote a book that costs money, and that's how I make my living now. And we only ask for, you know, for certain courses. The two courses to take, we expect people to be premier members, which is $5 a month or more. And that's how NLA keeps the lights on, through that $5 a month or more.
That's really great. And then also, what's the very first thing I should be doing right now?
Well, the very first thing you should do is, first of all, come to the seminar and bring everyone you can to this Saturday, and because we're going to lay the program out. And then, you know, you can sign up on our page in order to build, you know, become a committee of safety leader as far as building the process. You don't have to be the leader of the program, but you can participate with getting it started. It's all a matter of meeting with one or two other people like-minded that want to do something for coffee here and there as often as possible to discuss ideas, educate yourself, go through the books, plan, and in a couple of weeks you should be able to call a meeting together, maybe invite 15, 20 people, which is probably what it'll take to get it started. And then once the people start coming, you're getting them educated and you go through the process and following the book. We have it laid out in the handbooks, okay, and you click on the Committee of Safety Handbook, or let's see, Committee of Safety Organization Handbook, you click on that book, and that book will take you step by step. It starts in the beginning and brings you to the conclusion of creating a Committee of Safety. It's 71 pages, everything is downloadable for free. Again, there's very little. At some point in time, we just had to make some money somewheres to keep the lights and pay the bills. So, again, $5 a month. And if you can't afford it, if you're, you know, there are a few people from time to time you get that really is on limited income, Social Security, and they're barely making it, and $5 could be a hardship for them. So we'll let them in for free. We don't care. The information is important. Freely we have been given, you know, freely we have give back.
Well, when all this stuff started, I've pretty much immersed myself in the law, and I'm like really passionate about it, and I think it'd be an honor to try.
Well, you can get one heck of an education here if you have an interest in the true law, the common law. We teach, that's our focus, is the common law. You know, equity has its place, the codes, the statutes, the regulations, they have their place. You know, that is to control the people that work for government agencies or involved in commercial activities. And so there's certain regulations and requirements that they have to abide by. Statutes and codes are involved there too. But, you know, here's something that people don't realize, and people need to think about this because this is a huge thing. You know, these equity courts, they do not have a power. Only a court of law has the power to fine or incarcerate. That's it. Any equity court, any court that is involved and run by equity, traffic law, anything, criminal law, all of that, that has no power. That judge up there has no power to fine or incarcerate. Now, it is true that a person could be brought before a magistrate and be held until the trial for some reason, one reason or another. But we do have to be careful with that. But, you know, I've seen lots of judges put lots of people in jail. When you go to the town courts, the administrative courts, that power is not in them. They don't have that power. There is no place you can find that they have that power. Only the people can put people in jail. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to get started on these courses tonight. And I just want to thank you. I got a lot of respect for you guys. That's awesome what you're doing. So.
Okay, thank you.
We've
got a couple more callers, so we want to move on anyway. So, but thanks for the call, and hopefully we'll see you on Saturday and bring as many people as possible.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I've got a couple of callers. If we keep it short, I can get everybody in. It is 12 after midnight at this point here in New York, so, but we'll see what we can do. Let's take, Pottstown, PA. What's your first name from Pottstown, PA? Pennsylvania.
Hi, John. Can you hear me?
Yeah. How you doing?
Yeah. Hi, John. I'm just calling back with an update. I called in a couple weeks ago about the horrible bankruptcy judge, and I just wanted to give you an update on what has occurred. I did file an appeal with the Third Circuit, and I also filed a complaint of judicial misconduct. I did hear back from the circuit executive and they've got a docket number for the misconduct charge, but I have not heard back from the appellate court. I filed an informal brief. It's pretty short. It's just one paragraph, and I don't know if I can read it to you, but aside
well,
from that,
not now, but maybe next week if we find a little time. As long as it's not too long. But look at with filing for you said you filed for an appeal or something.
Yes.
You know, it's as simple as filing the intent, a letter of intent to the court, and then filing it to wherever they file it as far as the, you know, for the appeal, whatever court that would be. And you need to look at the law because, you know, they only give you so many days. I mean, New York.
Right. Well, I got it in. The issue was, of course, she kept denying the fee waiver. And then when I filed an appeal with the district court, she interfered with that appeal and denied the fee waiver for the district court and quashed my appeal to the district court. So I had to take it up to the Third Circuit.
Right. Well, you know, the whole process is corrupt and the whole system is out of whack. And, you know, the fact that they're asking money for justice, that's horrible as it is. That's evil right there. They want money in order for you to come in and get justice. And when you move things from one court to another, there usually is no fee. You know, once you're in the court system and you got a number, you could move it from one court to another. For instance, a traffic court, I can move it into federal court because there's no fee for that because there's a court system in play that's pushing forward for a higher court.
Right.
So there should be no fee anywhere here.
Okay, yeah. Now, one of the things this judge did that's kind of interesting is I was one day late in filing some of the initial forms, and she issued a order to show cause why I shouldn't be dismissed because I didn't file these documents timely. And I've got a hearing tomorrow. It's a telephonic hearing. I don't know if there's any court watchers out there that could
get on the call or anything. Yeah, they will probably be successful in kicking you out. But the two things you want to focus in on in their thinking and their minds, and again, this is a technical thing. This is not a big deal. I mean, they make a big deal out of everything unless they want it to, for their own purposes, of course. I mean, I've got a U.S. attorney that even confessed in court that he didn't have a good reason for going forward. And they were let back in anyway, okay? First of all, in order to get back in under their system and rules, two things have to be able to be proven. Number one, you have to prove that you have a chance of winning. In other words, you have to have a good, solid case, whether you're the defendant or whatever. But that's one thing. And the other thing is a good excuse. I mean, look, you had an emergency or a situation or whatever. Even if you forgot, to some degree, that could be a good excuse. This is so silly anyway. It's one day. But the thing is that if you have a good excuse, come with a good excuse, number one, on why you didn't make it in time, you were one day late, and number two, and ask for grace. Say, hey, listen, we're in accordance with justice, aren't we? I'd like to get some grace here. This is, you know, there was no bad intent here. The other thing, of course, is the fact that I have a really good chance of winning this case, so it needs to go forward. So those are the two things you want to bring up. I mean, you can argue the fact that what they're doing is unlawful, but it's not going to get you nowhere. But if you were in a court of justice, you would. Okay, I don't know if we lost the person. I don't see them in the queue no more. Anyway, we'll move on. Next caller, let's take Ross. Ross, you got the mic. Only a minute or two because I want one other caller and I need to go. Ross? I don't see Ross anymore either. Looks like we lost Ross. Okay, we'll try one other caller. Last call for Ross before I move on. Ross, are you there? Okay, we'll go to Tzak. Tzak, go right ahead. You got the mic.
Hey, John. Thank you for the time. I have a really quick question for you, and it's about a comment you often bring up. When there's when an issue becomes criminal, then a court of record becomes necessary, or something along those lines. So I'm wondering if you have some sort of legal source, a case for that, perhaps, off the top of your head?
Well, not off the top of my head. It sounds very, very familiar, and it does sound like a court ruling, a Supreme Court ruling. But there's lots of sources. You heard it. You didn't read it, I guess, right?
Well, I know you mentioned it today, and I took a note, and I know you've mentioned it before. And
it makes sense. It's logical, and therefore it's a maximum. You know, it has a truth to it. You know, an apparent truth is really a maxim. But the other thing is I know everything I've written, pretty much, I mean, especially in the book, I've got footnotes with all the sources. But offhand, I don't know where that came from.
All right, well, thank you for your time. I might reach out to you privately this week.
Okay, thank you. Okay, that was the last caller. Well, Ross, I'm back. Could try Ross again. Go ahead, Ross. You got the mic and I got a minute or two.
Okay, I asking about, because I do want to become an administrator, I can't do the transcription when someone dictates to me because I'm not exactly a fast typer.
You're not a fast typer, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, well, you don't have to be a fast typer. So.
And the problem also with my autism and my hearing, it's harder to process as what a normal person can process.
Well, look, if you can go through the course and be successful going through all the courses, and then you learn to be able to articulate these things, and, you know, I've spoken with you many times, you seem to be focused, and you seem to have a grip on common law to some degree, you know, the essence of it anyway, and, you know, I think you can do well. So you just have to go through the process like everyone else, and you'll be successful.
What courses have I taken?
You have to take all the courses. And
I did the government consent and the civic course.
Okay.
I can't access the constitutional course because it's not up anymore.
Yeah, I thought we put it back up. I'll talk. I know some people wanted it back up. It was supposed to go back up. I'll find out whether it's up there or not. If there isn't a big call for it, that kind of really is moot. Because we do have this in the government by consent course. We cover the Constitution, so that would be anyway. And we also got to cover it on a much, much heavier end. In the administrative course. Against the administrative course is going to be, you know, people are going to struggle with that one. But it's meant for people to struggle.
I was wondering, because I don't have any management experience and all that kind of thing, or administrative experience.
Well, again, everything's on-the-job training. And, and again, as long as you can get through things and you can communicate quite well. I don't see a problem.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call, Ross. Mm-hmm. We'll talk again soon, I'm sure. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, with that ends our program for tonight. Lord willing, we'll be back next Monday. And again, let me remind everybody of the Government by Consent seminar on Saturday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, right here in this room. I suggest people show up early. And especially people who don't have the app or anything and they want to download the app, you should do so now and play around with it to make sure it's a smooth transition coming into the room on Saturday. Okay, good night. Thanks for coming, everybody.